Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. I'm going to talk about the full frontal assault on working people as it continues. The GOP going around the state holding more hearings on how we're going to destroy things like prevailing wage and how they're going to pursue legislation that basically outlaws workers from talking to each other. But we believe in the First Amendment. So they keep telling us. I love the hypocrisy of the GOP. It's beautiful. We're also going to talk with author Hedrick Smith about his book, Who Stole the American Dream? We know who did. the multinational corporations, Wall Street. Pretty simple. Our insane trade agreements. We'll talk to him about his book. Also going to talk to former senior advisor to President Obama's drug czar, Dr. Kevin Sabat, about the legalization of marijuana. He's got a new book out, basically the Just Say No book, Reefer Sanity. So we'll have a discussion on, you know, should we be making marijuana legal? I'm in favor of at least at the minimum decriminalization. I think it's stupid to be locking people up in jail, but we'll have an interesting discussion around that. Also going to take your phone calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Big news today, a couple of big stories that I want to get to right away because I think they're both really important. The first one, Representative Chris Van Hollen, the Democrat from Maryland, along with Public Citizen and a number of other campaign finance reform groups, they have unveiled a lawsuit over the IRS's handling of the tax-exempt applications. You may remember the conservatives were going ballistic. Oh, my goodness, they're going after Tea Party people. And then when the shouting and the fake news on Fox, you know, after that kind of subsided a little bit, you realize they were really looking into all the groups. They were doing kind of their job. And I said right from the very beginning, when the moment it hit, I asked the question, why are we giving any of these groups tax-exempt status? Look, I'm as much a freedom of speech guy as anyone, but I'm sorry. I don't think we should be giving the wealth class any more tax loopholes. I don't think we should be giving the very well-to-do any more opportunity to hide their money or to shield it from taxes and use it against us. So in looking at this, you know, I say, you know, it's about time. This should have happened, you know, the day after this broke. A lawsuit, you know, we should have been pursuing this. Now, as they say, current IRS rules say that groups seeking a 501c4 status can't have politics as their primary purpose. Generally understood to mean that those organizations must devote more than half of their resources towards education, towards social welfare, those kind of things. But when you got people like Karl Rove running around saying, "Oh, we're gonna get rid of Obama," it's kind of hard, really, to make an argument that they're not a purely political arm. And, you know, as I look at this, to me, what I hope comes out of this is we end that tax exempt status. Look, if the country's in as bad a shape as the Republicans are screaming that we are, if our debt problems are as bad as all of the T-twits who are screaming from the sky's falling, if it's as bad as that, and we're going to hear a lot of the screaming. We're going to hear a lot of screaming come August or come October, November, when we reach the debt ceiling again. You're going to hear a lot of it. Why are we giving more tax breaks for things that are clearly non-productive? I mean, just step back from a second. Lose the politics. Lose all of the right, the left, lose that. Simply look at it from a purely financial, purely fiscal means of thought. These groups produce nothing. Well, that's not true. They produce a whole lot of revenue for Comcast and Time Warner, AOL Time Warner, and these big media conglomerates because they spend a lot of money on radio and TV ads. So in that vein, maybe you're right. It's a nice way for billionaires to take some of their money, put it into one of these non-taxable groups where they shield their taxes. They then spend it on making themselves even wealthier. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's money laundering. But, you know, we need it, Rick. It's good for public debate, spirited debate. Nonsense. It's shouting at each other. There's no spirited debate going on. You got a bunch of right-wing cranks running around saying, we need to defund Obamacare. And we're paying for it. Look, say what you want. I don't want to pay for that. We should take that money, put it into education. Aha, yeah, education. See, the problem with that is the right-wing cranks don't want that. Because if you're a critical thinking citizen, if you're someone who has half a brain, you look at these ads and you think about them, you go, wow, it's a bunch of BS. They don't want that. Not at all. They want mindless minions. They want people like, you know, Republicans in Louisiana who 29% of them thinks Obama didn't respond to Hurricane Katrina right. He's more responsible for Hurricane Katrina than Bush was when Bush was president. And 44% of them thought, well, I don't know who's more to blame. Oh, I don't know. They were equally to blame. We're one screwed up society, I'll tell you. And I look at this and I go, you know, when you're looking at 73% of the Republicans in Louisiana who think that, or who think that Obama had more blame than Bush, or they don't know who had more blame, the right wing cranks are winning. They know that all they have to do is keep pounding us. And that we're dumb enough to pay for it. And I loved how they got us all riled up. Say, hey, they're going after Tea Party people. Instead of going, hey, wait a minute. They're laundering tax dollars. For me, that was the take right from the beginning. So I'm glad to see Chris Van Hollen has done that. The other big story today, obviously, is Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning was sentenced to 35 years in prison because of the leaks to WikiLeaks. He had faced up to 90 years in prison. The government, the prosecutor, they wanted 60. 35 was the decision. So I'm looking at this, and, you know, obviously the government's not happy. They wanted 60. And obviously some of the right-wing cranks who wanted life and wanted them executed, they're obviously not happy. People like me not happy because I think he should have just got, they should have released him. Because 3 years of torture, I think, is enough. I think he's done his time. I think he's paid the bill, paid the freight. He's also received a dishonorable discharge. He'll have to forfeit his pay and benefits. And his rank was reduced, which, you know, you're going to reduce his rank while dishonorably discharge him? Really? Well, okay. Some people called him a traitor who hurt the country. People like me think, you know, this is a whistleblower who really shined some light on what goes on. His statement that I thought was very interesting, and, you know, you got to give him, I give this kid all the credit in the world. He said, I never intended to hurt anyone. I only wanted to help people. When I chose to disclose classified information, I did so out of love for my country and a sense of duty to others. He said, if you deny my request for a pardon, I will serve my time knowing that sometimes you have to pay a heavy price to live in a free society. I got to tell you, I give him credit for having a conscience. And you go, he got classified secret stuff. I don't know. I'm not so sure. The more I looked into this, not so sure. Because what was he accused of? Well, he released a bunch of stuff, a video, for instance, that, well, showed an Army Apache helicopter firing on a group of Iraqis. One of the people, I guess, or that turned out to, one of them turned out to be a journalist, or a couple of journalists, if I remember right, from Reuters. We didn't really want to put that out there. Prosecutors said that by leaking the video, militants could learn about our tactics because they could watch the video and they could, you know, they'd know what we do. And my first thought when I read that is I'm going, you mean shooting reporters? That's what they would learn? I think reporters would be very interested to know that we're shooting reporters. He's also accused, and he did leak something that the prosecutors had called war logs. Or I guess WikiLeaks called them war logs. But the prosecutors were not happy because it actually showed that the number of civilian casualties, you know, people not Al-Qaeda, considerably higher than we had reported, and that kind of made us look bad. Now, there is something to the claim that WikiLeaks didn't redact some of the names, which I guess in the future stuff that they released, they did do a little bit, but they did a better job of doing. But again, the prosecutor couldn't show where anyone's life or anyone had been harmed. The other part of the charge was that, you know, he had leaked stuff related to Guantanamo Bay. We know who the detainees are. Sad reality is, you know, no matter what the prosecutor said, most of the information in there had been already publicly released and other documents. So there was really nothing there. But the biggest part of this, and this is the reason that I truly think that they went after him with guns a-blazing, and that this had to be a strong message, and that this had to be, if you screw with us, this will happen to you, so don't do it. There were hundreds of thousands of the State Department cables. And, you know, for a while they were kind of, people were joking about, you know, some of the writing and the loose language in the writing. It basically showed that diplomacy is a bunch of lies. That what we say to people in private is rarely what we say in public. And does anybody think that that's not how diplomacy works? You sit down and you have a conversation, then publicly you go, okay, we got to make a public statement. How are we going to spin this so that people don't know what we really are doing? Come on. Now, the prosecutors have said that, you know, by releasing these cables, well, you've caused diplomatic headaches. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, people tend to not like to be lied to. I mean, just a thought. Now, prosecutors claim that, well, you know, other countries don't want to deal with us. When you lie to them, just a thought. But I got to be honest with you. I look at this and I want transparent, accountable government. And this kid, for a very short moment, opened that up. And he's going to pay 35 years of his life, potentially out in 8 with good behavior. And I personally think that as Obama leaves office, he'll probably give him clemency or something to get him out. With the agreement that you don't talk about it, you don't write books, you just go away. That's my thought on it. But we shall soon see. But I, again, my belief should have been released. 3 years of torture, that's enough. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We want the world and we want it now. We're gonna take it anyhow. We want the hellwind.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Fast food and retail workers who went on strike in 7 U.S. cities are calling for a nationwide day of strikes August 29th. It's part of the fight for $15 an hour, and the right to organize unions without employer intimidation. Terrence Wise, a 34-year-old father of three who earns $9.30 an hour after 8 years at a Burger King, is urging fast food and low-wage workers nationwide to join the growing low-wage worker movement with strikes on August 29th. 2 straight weeks of daily arrests for singing protest songs without a permit at Wisconsin's Capitol, and the people participating in the Solidarity Sing-Along remain unintimidated. This is what it sounded like Tuesday as Governor Scott Walker's Capitol cops continue to arrest peaceful singers and to shove reporters trying to record the arrests.
I'm dissenting against the policies of this administration.
I'm recording events, is all I'm doing. I'm a credentialed reporter.
There's a quote at the end of episode 3 of Eyes on the Prize that hurt Pee-wee more than it hurt me. May they learn to live by their consciences.
What's your name? Samantha. I'm a reporter, I'm doing my job.
Dee Lemke. My dad's here with me. I hope he's not disappointed.
The people!
It's fun.
United.
Come try it.
Be defeated! The people! United!
This recording.
The Office and Professional Employees International Union is adding 2,000 workers to its ranks. The Independent Union of Telephone Workers in Puerto Rico has decided to affiliate with OPEIU. The new workers' union will be OPEIU Local 1971. Auto manufacturing is ground to a halt in South Africa as auto workers press for higher wages. Jesse Russell reports.
Port Elizabeth, South Africa is known as the Detroit of Africa for its high concentration of auto plants. Most of the major vehicle manufacturers have plants in the port city, and they're all facing strike action. An estimated 30,000 auto workers have been walking the picket lines since Monday, seeking a 14% wage increase. The automakers have offered an 8% wage increase. The United States is the largest importer of vehicles manufactured in Port Elizabeth, but the vehicles are exported to 148 countries around the globe. The auto industry is so important to South Africa's economy that it amounts for 12% of the country's exports. Toyota, Volkswagen, General Motors, Ford, and Mercedes-Benz all have plants in the country. Workers are represented by the National Union of Metal Workers, and the union has said the strike will intensify if a compromise can't be reached.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Well, we're going to start in a couple weeks with our budget adjustment bill. The first step is we're going to deal with collective bargaining for all public employee unions. Because you divide and conquer.
Walker, we're going to use divide and conquer. You see, if we can keep those working people, we keep them divided, we keep them pitted against each other, then we can do whatever the hell we want. We can pilfer and rob and steal and destroy their education system and deny them health care and do all those wonderful things that profit the very well to do. Isn't that wonderful? It takes me back to the 1880s. Jay Gould, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. Kind of makes me wonder. I got an email today from the good folks over at the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, which, you know, I'm sure they don't know their history, but again, another one of these kind of front groups used by the very well-to-do of the past to divide and destroy working people's conditions. They're pimping this House Bill 1154, which, according to them, did you know that Pennsylvania gives working people the ability to threaten to use weapons of mass destruction and without fear of any repercussion whatsoever. If you listen to the Citizens Alliance, they don't tell me who funds them. I've asked them on a couple of occasions, not really willing to tell me where their money comes from. But they seem to think that this is perfectly okay. I'm not so sure, which is why we've asked our good friend Attorney Erwin Aronson to come talk to us about House Bill 1154 and this claim. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here on a very sad eve of an outrageous piece of legislative conduct sponsored by, and our listeners need to know this and mark it down, Representative Ron Miller of York County down in Jacobus, Pennsylvania, is the prime sponsor of this hocus pocus phony House Bill 1154, and the Citizens Alliance should really be recharacterized and appropriately named. It's the Citizens Alliance, because they're a lion about this one more than anything I've seen in recent years.
This claim, and I've heard this a number of times, that of course the Citizens Alliance, they've been on the front of this, pushing this because that's what their funders want, that there's a special provision for workers who are union members to be able to threaten people and intimidate and harass them. Is there such a thing in the law that gives me the ability to stalk people?
Not only is there nothing in the law that gives you the ability to stalk people, stalking is illegal in Pennsylvania. What there is, and I'm one of the guys responsible for it, in 1993, when Pennsylvania joined several other states, appropriately amending its criminal code, its crimes code, to create legislation that makes stalking criminal conduct, the legislature wisely recognized that somebody could misconstrue stalking into being something that would engage or touch upon the federally regulated and protected as a matter of national law conduct in organizing and collective bargaining. So, the General Assembly, in three sections of the Crimes Code, one having to do with stalking, one having to do with harassment, I say harassment because of my ridiculous training, and the third having to do with the threat of use of weapons of mass destruction, the legislature exempted from that the term labor dispute, as that term labor dispute is defined in a law passed all the way back in 1937, the Pennsylvania Labor Anti-Injunction Act. And what that language says is that a labor dispute is not subject, conduct in a labor dispute is not subject to the otherwise criminal nature of harassment, stalking, or the threat of use of weapons of mass destruction. What the law says is that the term labor dispute is defined for Pennsylvania law purposes to be a controversy concerning the terms or conditions of employment or concerning the association or representation of persons in negotiating, fixing, maintaining, changing, or seeking to arrange terms or conditions of employment or concerning employment relations or controversies arising out of the respective interests of employer and employee, regardless of whether or not there is a strike. It doesn't say anything about the use of weapons of mass destruction. It doesn't create any special exemption. What it does do is reflect national labor policy that says it is the policy of the government of the United States of America to encourage people to have the right to freely choose whether or not they want to belong to a labor organization. And what Representative Miller and his co-sponsors have proposed, and what the Pennsylvania House of Representatives Judiciary Committee is having a hearing on tomorrow under the chairmanship of Dauphin County Representative Ron Marsico, is legislation that would criminalize federally protected rights. If ever there was a time when the civil rights of people to freely associate and freely speak in the United States of America, the greatest democracy on the planet, to have those rights impinged and impeded and criminalized under the color of state law, this is it. And people listening to this show, people in every corner of Pennsylvania should be outraged. I honestly don't believe, Rick, that the voters in Pennsylvania sent people like Representative Ron Miller to come to Harrisburg, to come to the state capitol, to be paid $83,000+ a year of taxpayer money, to get another $600 or $700 a month in a taxpayer-funded car allowance, to get a taxpayer-financed health care plan for himself and his family, to get a taxpayer-financed pension, to get a taxpayer-paid-for office in Harrisburg and another one in his legislative district, or maybe two, to get paid an additional $165, maybe $185 a day for actually showing up for work. I don't think the people of Pennsylvania sent Representative Miller and others of his ilk who are sponsoring and co-sponsoring this kind of venomous, poisonous legislation to restrict our civil rights, our right to freely speak, our right to assembly. I don't think they sent them to Harrisburg for this purpose.
I know they didn't. I know I didn't. But when I look at this and I'm looking at the hearing that they're going to have tomorrow morning at 10:30, they're saying that, well, we need to look into assaults, further providing the offenses of harassment, stalking, and threats of mass destruction weapons. The first question I ask is, are we looking at employers too? Because when I spoke with Rick Bloomingdale, president of the AFL-CIO here in Pennsylvania, on Monday night, he claimed that something like 88% of all claims of harassment and stalking, if you will, were from the employer. And then I asked, does that include the closed captive meetings? Does that include the mandatory one-on-one meetings? Is that part of it as well? And is anybody going to talk about that?
Well, I'm pretty confident that somebody is going to talk about that, because there are going to be people who actually represent workers who appear at this hearing as well. But this is a sandbag operation if I've ever seen one. Statistically, Rick Bloomingdale has it exactly right. The National Labor Relations Board statistics for last year, the most recent year for which statistics are available, show that of the complaints that the Labor Board issued for violations of people's rights, approximately 89% of all complaints issued were issued against employers, as compared to under 10%, 9.1% in fact, that were issued against unions. And so, therefore, we have a problem, of course, according to Representative Miller, and we need to criminalize my career. We need to criminalize what Rick Bloomingdale does for a living. We need to criminalize what every union member does. And so now, if they pass their law, if you were to ask somebody to sign an authorization card demonstrating interest in a union, you would be subject to criminal prosecution in Pennsylvania. Forget about the fact that the policy of the government of the United States since 1935 has been to protect this very conduct. So you remember the firefighter who's running into a building when the rest of us are running out?
Yep.
The guy who's the little league coach on your kid's baseball team? The home health care worker that sat up all night with your ailing grandmother so that you could get some rest? You know those people. You know the gal who fixed your car? The guy who changed the flat tire when you got a flat on the Pennsylvania Turnpike? Their conduct under this legislation would make them all criminals.
Well, I look at this, Irwin, and I got to be honest. I mean, to me, this is mission accomplished on a massive level, because what you've done is not only since the 80s have we been pushing this individual society, hooray for me, screw everybody else, but now we're almost criminalizing talking to your neighbors, and really.
We're not almost criminalizing it. It's being criminalized. If this were to pass, this is being criminalized.
But these are the people who tell us that they love the Constitution, especially that First Amendment thing.
Well, they love the Constitution, except as it applies to those of us who have to work for a living. This is all so very instructive. Labor law in this country and labor management relations have been unique in the world, in that the policy of the government of the United States is not to favor business or to favor workers. It's to create and retain and foster neutrality, strict neutrality on the part of the government, to keep the government out of this activity, this wholly private activity. And that is aimed at assuring that there's a balance between labor and management. This legislation is aimed at upsetting the balance of giving one side or the other an unreasonable unfair advantage, of creating a sideshow. Now, instead of negotiating a contract at a bargaining table, we will have this sideshow of people being prosecuted and incarcerated for what? For exercising their federally protected rights. One would have thought that in the days since Jim Crow, we had moved on from this. Not only have we not moved on, but we have people who, under color of law, financed by we taxpayers, are attempting to create crimes of federally protected conduct. And make no mistake, you have to read a little more. You have to be where I am. There are pending today in Pennsylvania's General Assembly 183 amendments to the Pennsylvania Crimes Code, each of which expands definitions of crimes and criminal conduct. So when we remove this protection in Pennsylvania law, in the anti-stalking statute, in the anti-harassment statute, in the anti-terroristic threat statute, to make this conduct criminal, there are 183 other pieces of legislation waiting in the wings to make all kinds of other conduct subject to this and then subject people whose rights are protected to criminal prosecution for each of those events as well. And, oh, by the way, there are three additional bills pending that expand the criminal harassment statute.
So let me get this straight then, because, you know, I'm thinking of some of my friends who, you know, they really don't care about unions or labor. They're never going to be members. They've told me numerous times, I don't care. What you're talking about affects them, because if this changes, it changes a whole lot of other stuff that eventually will affect them.
Oh, absolutely. It'll affect them right now. Look, a labor dispute, as I read that definition to you a few minutes ago, is not merely where a union is involved. If a couple of people just are a little bit upset about how they're treated at work, that's going to become criminal conduct, Rick. That's harassment. That's stalking. And maybe if these people are about themselves and really want to do it to us, they redefine what a weapon of mass destruction is to become my mouth. Maybe my mouth is a weapon of mass destruction, and maybe I should be incarcerated for using it. And I'm not talking about 1955 Soviet Union. I'm talking about 2003 Pennsylvania. They are about to start the repeal of the 20th century.
I wouldn't say about to start. I say they've been long on their way. And I look at this poll, Irwin, that I came across over at the St. Louis Business Journal, because in Missouri they're talking about putting this euphemistically named right to work law on the ballot there. And even in the push poll that put out, the question was, should Missouri pass right to work law, letting workers decide whether or not to join unions or financially support a union? One of the answers was yes, individual workers should be able to decide. The other one was no, it will erode collective bargaining power. 79% said no. And I think Pennsylvania is in the same vein. I think as these Republicans keep pushing this stuff, don't they at some point stand to be held accountable? And can't we hold them accountable?
Well, we must. We now have an obligation. This is not, Rick, about Democrats and Republicans. It's not about liberals or conservatives. It's not about are you progressive or aren't you. This is about a simple question. Is this a government of the people, by the people, for the people, or is this a government of an elite who have bought and paid for a hand-picked group of legislators whose role in life is to strip us of our right to speak with one another, our right to join or refuse to join an organization, our right to object to being mistreated on the job. Understand that criminal conduct, true criminal conduct, is already punishable, deeply punishable, seriously punishable. If somebody engages in violence in the context of labor-management relations, that conduct is not protected.
You mean like last Thursday when someone went to run over five members of Sheet Metal Workers Local 19 in Philadelphia?
That's exactly what I mean. That's precisely what I mean. And the sheriff in Philadelphia, the police in Philadelphia, arrested the perpetrators of that crime that was taking place in the context of labor-management relations, because trying to kill people, trying to injure people, trying to maim people, trying to cripple people, trying to use an automobile as a weapon of mass destruction, a vehicle, it wasn't an automobile, it was actually a truck, as a weapon of mass destruction, is a crime in Pennsylvania. It always has been since we've had vehicles, and it always will be. This is not about that. Once these heathens are done portraying people like Rick Bloomingdale, like me, like that firefighter or the cop or the school teacher or the healthcare worker that I described a few minutes ago, as mobsters and hoodlums, what we have is the stark reality. You want to know terrorism? You want to know harassment? Employers fire workers every day in the United States of America and here in Pennsylvania for doing what? For saying they might like to have a union. And the result of that firing is that people are compelled to deal with the harsh and stark reality of losing their homes, of having their utilities shut off, of not being able to buy groceries, of being incapable of sending their kids off to school with a new book bag next week. That's violence. That's terrorism. That is harassment. Couple that with the stalking that we know goes on every day. You mentioned it. The captive audience meeting. The employers, during a union organizing drive, calling people's homes, bringing people in, telling them if the union is elected democratically by a majority of the workers that the plant's going to close. That's harassment. That's stalking. And that's using the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. I'm going to destroy your family way of life. But the United States Chamber of Commerce did a hocus-pocus phony baloney study and came up with this outrageous claim that somehow or another Pennsylvania law exempts labor organizations and their members from the criminal statutes of this state, and therefore we need to criminalize federally protected conduct, criminalize my right to associate with you, indeed criminalize my right to say what I say on this radio show.
So what do we do, Erwin?
Well, first of all, I think everybody who can that's listening tonight needs to be at that hearing in the state capitol tomorrow before the House Law and Justice Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, forgive me. And they need to see this close up and hear what is said and hear and watch how their elected representatives deal with this, because no one who calls himself or herself an American, a Pennsylvanian, from any piece of the political spectrum, can honestly and sincerely attach that characterization to themselves and be supportive of this bill and indeed do anything other than oppose this legislation. And the second is people need to begin absolutely without fear and without trepidation and without reservation, emailing, calling, writing to their state representatives, regardless of what party their representatives are affiliated with, and ask them to stop this insanity of criminalizing what has been protected conduct in the United States of America since the 1930s, indeed since the 1920s. This is an outrage, and people need to speak up. Everybody needs to remember that these representatives work for us. We don't work for them.
Absolutely, and we need to hold them accountable. And you're right, it's not about party, but the party right now who's assaulting us are these Republicans who tell us that they want to get government out of our lives. And I look at this, and this puts that right smack in our lives.
Well, they tell us they want smaller government. But, you know, one of the things this does is it creates a huge unfunded mandate for every local police force, every county district attorney to have to prosecute cases that they just invented as being crimes. And, indeed, these are all going to end up going all the way to the Supreme Court if this passes and they get prosecuted, because there's a long-standing principle in American democracy of where the federal government has occupied the field, states cannot legislate or regulate. And the federal government has occupied this field.
So basically what you're saying then is we're going to be spending more money that we don't have, that we should be spending on education and healthcare, on more bad law. I mean, I look at this governor and I look at what the legislature has done, you know, Act 13, you look at the gerrymandering, the voter suppression law, you name it, on down the list. How much money have we wasted on this bad legislation, on bad ideas like privatizing the wine and spirit shops and privatizing the lottery? What, $3 million on the scheme to privatize the lottery we just threw away?
Yeah, a million here, a million there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money, right? The real piece of reality is not just the money, although that's bad enough. The real piece of this is that at a time when kids are finding that their schools can't afford to buy books, when families are finding that they can't get access to health care, when people are being compelled to adhere to some crazy means test to qualify for access to food, we're wasting our time and our energy not in rectifying and dealing with those serious problems, but instead we're going to create a crime that is illegal to create. And remember, every member of the General Assembly raised his or her right hand and swore to uphold, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America and the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's first article in its Constitution is a declaration of rights, the rights of humanity, the rights of mankind. And these people who say they're such worshipers of the Constitution have turned their back on it. And indeed, I believe they're urinating on it. And they're asking you and me and all of our listeners to pay for it. Not only to pay for it through our tax dollars, but to pay for it with our freedom, because if I am prosecuted under a change in this statute, I won't be at home with my family. I'll be in a jail somewhere because I did my job.
Well, let's hope it doesn't get to that, and let's hope that we get enough people to pay attention, wake up, and hold these folks accountable. Irwin, it's great talking with you. I appreciate the update, and we're gonna keep an eye on this tomorrow.
I hope so, and you know, after the hearing, if need be, I'll make myself available to the Rick Smith Show one more time to talk about what happens next.
Terrific. Look forward to it. Thanks so much, Irwin. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Quick break, right back. Your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The rich, as F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote, are different from you and me. But had F. Scott known Michael Dell, he would have added this corollary. The super rich are different from the merely rich. Dell, the computer magnate, is a preening peer of the multi-billionist corporate class. Thus, if any of our society's rules get in his way, he just changes them. Hey, he says, I'm super rich. I make my own rules. And that's what he's doing now in a power play against his own corporate shareholders. Earlier this year, he made a lowball bid to buy them out, fully expecting them to say, yes, sir. But as the July 18th date approached for shareholders to cast their ballots and rubber stamp Dell's bad deal, most were voting against him. So Mr. Super Rich simply had his board delay the vote to July 24th so he could wrangle some of those ornery owners of his company to his side. But oops, he was still losing when the 24th arrived, so he imperiously ordered Election Day moved again. One major stock owner decried the tyranny, exclaiming that this is not a banana republic. Oh, not only did El Jefe move the vote to September, but he actually directed the board to change the rules of voting to assure that this time he would win. Previously, shareholders who did not cast a ballot were considered to be against the deal. Now, their shares won't count at all. More significantly, the voter pool was expanded in Dell's favor by allowing speculators who bought shares as late as August 13th to cast ballots. This is Jim Hightower saying, the upshot is that King Michael will grab the multi-billion-dollar corporation by imperial decrees that will stiff common shareholders who will lose millions of dollars. And that's how the rich get richer at the expense of the rest of us. It's easy, you see, when you get to make up the rules and go along.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So The Hill has their annual 50 Richest Members of Congress report out. You want to talk about the who's who of wealth. Daryl Issa, of course, led up the richest members of Congress in 2012, worth somewhere around $355 million. There were 29 Republicans in the top 50. 37 of the top 50 were from the House, because you've seen a bunch of big-moneyed House members, Tea Party guys mostly, I'll get away from, I don't want to pay taxes. And you wonder, when you look at these uber-wealthy people who really, they're completely disconnected from you and me. They don't know what it's like to lead a day in our lives. They don't. So it's not surprising to me that you see things like Chairman Miller is going to do tomorrow, assaulting workers. It's not surprising to me that there's another hearing going on tomorrow to steal wages from workers and undo the prevailing wage law. It's not surprising to me. And it's not surprising to me that the very well-to-do, they're taken care of. And I go back to the lawsuit, you know, filed today by Representative Chris Von Holland, the Democrat from Maryland, and Public Citizen. trying to do away with this money laundering that gives money to groups like the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, which, you know, I go back and I guess it's just because I know the history of it. You know, it's one of those, you go back to the 100 years ago, back to the 1880s, 1890s, back to that time when you had these groups who were well-funded by the billionaires, the citizens alliances that popped up all around the country, who basically were the same as they are today. Well, we don't want to pay taxes, and we hate those unions because we don't want people actually organizing and saying, you know, we want some of the wealth that we create. We want to give money to groups that are going to pimp our stuff. And I look at the report done today by Lee Fong, a friend of ours here at the program, that he did over at The Nation, pointing out that GE gave $1 million to this shill group, this fix the debt shill group, who understand that, you know, look, I'm not against the idea of fixing our debt problems. I'm just not willing to do it by gutting Medicare and Social Security. I'm just not willing to do it by stealing food out of the mouths of children. Sorry, not willing to go there. You want to talk about fixing some of our problems, raise the cap on Social Security? We can talk. But the fact GE gave this front group $1 million donation, which, tax deductible? yes. And as the New York Times pointed out, GE, one of the people, in my view, responsible for our debt problem, 2010, GE, the huge multinational corporation, I mean, multi-billion-dollar corporate enterprise, paid no federal taxes in 2010. They were one of the 47%. And you go back and you look at the money that GE has given, you know, all of these right-wing front groups like the Heritage Foundation and Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform. You look at all the money that they've given, and of course they've gotten the write-off. Nice way to launder money. And you wonder why we have a system that's set up where Corbett puts a T-twit over at the Department of Revenue, and why our EPA is basically staffed by drillers. We wonder why legislation goes towards these campaign contributions, means perks, means tax cuts, means special interest, means all the advantages that you and I never get. I mean, look at the money this $1 million that this fix the debt group that we're going to launder through, that they're going to use against us. Because they're going to be running ads and they're going to set up shill groups. Like, I think there was one called Kick the Can, or The Can Kicks Back, or some nonsense. That's saying, well, you know, young people, it's grandpa who's killing us. We got to get rid of grandpa. Grandpa's pension and his health care and all that's too expensive. We need to do away with it. Paul Blumenthal, Huffington Post, he tweeted earlier that J.P. Morgan Chase gave the Fix the Debt people $500,000. Huh. Another person who has aided in making the debt so much worse. And you go, well, how'd that all work out? Do you remember after the collapse, caused by the big banks, caused by the huge multinationals? Do you remember the big collapse? Do you remember the fear that they kept throwing out, that they were worried? Oh, we'd be worried that we would be like Japan and we would have a lost decade. Remember that? Well, according to a new report out by the Economic Policy Institute, we've already got the lost decade. It's already happened. Since 2000, productivity has gone up nearly 25%. Now, in the old days, pre-Reagan, as productivity rose, wages rose. I mean, they matched each other. Productivity went up, wages went up, everybody got wealthier and got in a better position together. We all rose together. Reagan comes, fires the Patco workers, tax insults unions, and starts really pedal to the metal, going after workers' rights. You see the decoupling. Productivity continues to go up, but wages flatline. And in fact, they actually go down. And what EPI has found out, what the Economic Policy Institute has found out in this most recent report, a decade of flat wages, is that median hourly income, the hourly wage, has actually less than it was in 2000. It's actually gone down. And that the people who are in that upper 10%, that upper tier, their wages have gone up by 10%. They're better. They're that much better off. According to the report in 2000, the median American income was $768 a week. Just before the Bush collapse in 2008, it had hit $770. So in 8 years, it went up $2 a week. Wow. Wow. $2. Since 2008, from 2008 to 2012, it actually dropped $2. So it went from before the collapse up $2, back down $2. We're right where we were in 2000. Productivity, however, since 2000 has gone up almost 25%. And since the recession, productivity's gone up by 8%, wages have fallen. And the report concludes that, and you know, nothing new to anybody who listens to this program, globalization, deregulations, weak unions, lower labor standards, such as a weak minimum wage, that's what's destroyed this virtuous capitalist cycle that we had talked about. As productivity goes up, wages go up. We share in the wealth together. And the authors of this basically have been saying what I've been saying for years. We need stronger minimum wage laws. We need stronger rights for workers to bargain collectively and get some of the fruits of their labor. It is that simple. It doesn't come down to anything more simple or basic than that. But what you've got is you've got Sherman Miller and these Republicans who see this and they go, well, wait a second. People are going to start thinking, well, we better start organizing. We better head them off at the pass. We better criminalize it. We better make it illegal. And we better make sure that these people know it's illegal. We need to put them in their place. That's what tomorrow's hearing is about. That's what this nonsense by the Citizens Alliance is all about. It's keeping you and me and our coworkers, it's keeping us in our place. And it's keeping us divided and fearful of each other. And we need to be pushing back against it. Going to take a quick break, right back with hour two. Going to find out who stole the American dream. Stick around. You're not going to want to miss this.
10% of the people own 90% of the world. 10% of the people own 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Fast food and retail workers who went on strike in 7 U.S. cities are calling for a nationwide day of strikes August 29th. It's part of the fight for $15 an hour, and the right to organize unions without employer intimidation. Terrence Wise, a 34-year-old father of three who earns $9.30 an hour after 8 years at a Burger King, is urging fast food and low-wage workers nationwide to join the growing low-wage worker movement with strikes on August 29th. 2 straight weeks of daily arrests for singing protest songs without a permit at Wisconsin's Capitol, and the people participating in the Solidarity Sing-Along remain unintimidated. This is what it sounded like Tuesday as Governor Scott Walker's Capitol cops continue to arrest peaceful singers and to shove reporters trying to record the arrests.
I'm dissenting against the policies of this administration.
I'm recording events, that's all I'm doing. I'm a credentialed reporter.
There's a quote at the end of episode 3 of Eyes on the Prize. It hurt Pee-wee more than it hurt me. May they learn to live by their consciences.
What's your name? I'm a reporter. I'm doing my job.
D. Lemke. My dad's here with me. I hope he's not disappointed.
The people!
It's fun.
United.
Come try it.
Be defeated! The people! United!
This recording.
The Office of Professional Employees International Union is adding 2,000 workers to its ranks. The Independent Union of Telephone Workers in Puerto Rico has decided to affiliate with OPEIU. The new workers' union will be OPEIU Local 1971. Auto manufacturing is ground to a halt in South Africa as auto workers press for higher wages. Jesse Russell reports.
Port Elizabeth, South Africa is known as the Detroit of Africa for its high concentration of auto plants. Most of the major vehicle manufacturers have plants in the port city, and they're all facing strike action. An estimated 30,000 auto workers have been walking the picket lines since Monday, seeking a 14% wage increase. The automakers have offered an 8% wage increase. The United States is the largest importer of vehicles manufactured in Port Elizabeth, but the vehicles are exported to 148 countries around the globe. The auto industry is so important to South Africa's economy that it amounts for 12% of the country's exports. Toyota, Volkswagen, General Motors, Ford, and Mercedes-Benz all have plants in the country. Workers are represented by the National Union of Metal Workers, and the union has said the strike will intensify if a compromise can't be reached.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, I go back to this report by the Economic Policy Institute, A Decade of Flat Wages, and it sticks in my mind after the collapse. It kept saying, well, we don't want to. We're not going to be like Japan. Have a decade, a lost decade. Well, congratulations. We've had a couple of lost decades, to be honest with you, especially if you work for a living in this country. And the sad reality is you know, we're working harder and harder, longer, well, for less. And I know so many people who are busting their behinds, falling behind, and still believe that it's, you know, if I just work harder, pull myself up by my bootstraps, because we believe in that American dream. And I got to be honest with you, someone ripped it off. And here to answer the question, who stole the American dream? I've got Hedrick Smith. He is the author of the book, Who Stole the American Dream? We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com to his website, hedricksmith.com. Hedrick, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick Smith, it's delightful to be with you. I appreciate it. You got an important program.
So, you know, that's a huge question. I mean, you look at this report put out by EPI that shows over the last 12 years, productivity's gone up by 25%, and wages have actually gone backwards.
You know, if you go back further, over the last 30 years, you go back to 1978, productivity's gone up 80%. Average median household income has gone up 10%, and the main reason it's gone up is because more women are working more hours. Census Bureau told us last year, from 1978 to 2011, the average worker was getting the same pay and benefits in 2011, adjusted for inflation, as in 1978. So gone backwards over the last 12 years, but over the last 35, gone nowhere. Three decades are going nowhere. And at the same time, the money's going to the top. The CEOs are making 300-400% more than they did back in 78. The top 1% is making more than 600%. 84% of the total monetary gains in this country since 1979, 84%, 5/6 of it, have gone to the top 1%. Everybody else has gotten 16%. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. No other country in the world is anything like it.
I mean, we're right back to the good old days of the 1880s.
We are. This is the third great wave of wealth accumulation in America by the super rich. There was the robber baron era of the late 1980s. And by the way, people have forgotten, that was the era of the Long Depression. That's what they called it. Lasted 20 years. And then you have the 1920s, the boom years, the roaring 20s, and then you have the stock market crash and the Great Depression. And then you have the next era of great wealth accumulation, 1990s, 2000, and it's followed by the financial crash of 2008. Same thing happens. We ought to learn by now, not just in terms of workers, but as a country, we ought to learn that this way of dividing the economic pie doesn't work for the country as a whole, not just average workers.
Well, that says you care about the country as a whole and not just a handful, their own self-interest.
Well, you know, that's one of the big problems. I don't know if you guys are interested in it, but I, when I went to postgraduate school, I studied at Oxford, the great English historian Arnold Toynbee. And Toynbee studied the history of 21 different civilizations, 6,000 years, ancient Persia, ancient Greece, ancient Inca, all that kind of stuff. And he said, every time you find that the creative elite, the leadership of a country, the founding fathers of our country, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, you name it, Monroe and so forth, John Adams, every time they go from being creative and creating a country with institutions to becoming the dominant elite, interested in increasing their own power and wealth, that's a sign. That's a very troubling sign. It's a dangerous sign for a civilization that it may be reaching its peak and heading down.
Yeah, I mean, you look
not
at
a good situation for us.
Yeah, and to highlight that, you look at the report out today over at The Hill that points out the 50 wealthiest people in Congress, of which Daryl Issa, the guy who's leading the destruction of the post office, $355 million he's supposedly worth. You got to wonder, what does he know what it's like to be an average working class stiff like you or me?
You know, Rick, you're right. It's certainly true for a guy like Daryl Issa. But what's interesting is most people don't know this. I didn't know this till I started doing the research on this book, Who Stole the American Dream, that the majority of the Tea Party Republicans elected to the House in 2010 are millionaires.
Yeah.
So the same thing applies. I mean, Issa is a huge millionaire. But even if you got a majority of the people are millionaires, no wonder they're against raising the taxes on the wealthy. It isn't just policy, it's self-interest. And
yep,
the same thing is true with not raising the minimum wage, cracking down on unions, that kind of thing. So it's not surprising. These people are representing their own self-interest. The problem is they've sort of faked out a lot of voters and made them think that they're really in favor of the common man, the common woman, the common family.
Well, let me ask you this, Hedrick, to kind of move back a bit, because, you talk about the American dream, and there's a lot of, it means a lot to a lot of different people. And for me, it means, an honest day's work, an honest day's pay, the ability to be able to support your family, that your kids are going to be able to go to college, you're going to be able to lead a safe, reasonable life. As I'm looking down the road, I think about my grandparents' generation who, when they came back from World War II, living through the Depression, they fought fascism, they went to the shop floor, and they fought for a decent living wage. I sadly believe we have to fight that fight again now. And I question you, why haven't we learned from history?
Well, we're so caught up in our own lives. We have all kinds of problems. We get the kids to raise, we get the kids to take care of, you got to run them around, you got to pay your taxes, you got to do your job, you got to commute to your job. People are flat stretched out. And, when people talk now about bringing the jobs back since the economic downturn back in 2008, 2009, but the jobs that are coming back are not as good as the jobs that we lost.
Right.
I mean, people were losing $14, $16, $18 an hour jobs, steady work, reasonably good benefits, health care paid largely by your employer, retirement benefit, enough money to pay your down payment, pay your mortgage. I mean, that is the American dream, steady job, good benefits, ability to buy a home and do better for your kids. Now people are scrambling. Sometimes a couple's between them, they've got four jobs. Or they've got a teenage kid, and that kid's got to have a good job to help support the family, but then the kid's supposed to be doing the homework, and how do you juggle that? Or the wife has got to be out working two jobs, and you got a child care problem, and how are you going to pay for that? The families are stressed, but part of the problem is that people have backed off. I mean, it was interesting to me. I started my reporting career back in the early 60s at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and then the consumer movement, the women's movement, the strong labor movement, the environmental movement. A lot of the good pay, the steady jobs, the fair policies you got out of Washington came from middle-class political power. People were engaged. The unions were strong. They could bargain with the big companies. These movements could push on Washington, could push on the private sector, get better benefits, get higher pay for women, maybe get child care, certainly get decent benefits for people with steady jobs. Now the power got shifted. Back in the late 70s, believe it or not, it happened even before Reagan, under the Democrats in Congress under Jimmy Carter. There was a power shift. There was what I call the revolt of the bosses. There were people in big business and corporate attorneys like Lewis Powell who were worried that union power, consumer power, environmental power, civil rights power, middle class power, people power in America was going to jam up the free enterprise system. And so they got alarmed and they got organized and they shifted the balance of power. They got, I mean, you went from 175 companies in 1971 had offices in Washington. 8 years later, 2,425.
Wow.
50,000 people worked for trade associations before Reagan got elected. 9,000 registered corporate lobbyists. Today, corporate lobbyists outspend labor lobbyists 60 to 1. A lot of people think it's close to even or maybe 3 to 1 or 4 to 1, 5 to 1. No, 60 to 1. In soft money, political donations, corporate PACs, businesses, business leaders, 90 to 1 against labor in soft money going into these super PACs, going to political parties and that kind of stuff. It's just lopsided.
Yeah, if I remember right.
It was a huge power shift that started back then and still with us. And we got to take the power back.
Absolutely. If I remember right, you brought up Lewis Powell, who would then become a Supreme Court justice thanks to President Nixon. He had called for a statesmanlike funding sum of 10% of all profits, which big corporations were happy to put in. And, you know, today, Chris Van Hollen, the Democratic representative from Maryland, has, along with Public Citizen and a number of other groups, have filed a lawsuit against the IRS for what was going on with the funding of these front groups that, is, to me, is basically money laundering. You've got these big companies now. You know, you go back to the 70s where, you know, they funded it because, you know, this is what they wanted. Now we're giving them a tax break to do the things they wanted to do back then. How insane have we gotten?
Well, we've gotten to the point where we've allowed the companies that move jobs overseas to pay lower tax rates than the companies that keep jobs in America. I mean, that, just for starters, that doesn't make any sense at all. And that's something we could fix. We could fix the corporations get $1.2 trillion in tax loopholes every year. That's the Treasury's estimate. If you closed half of those loopholes, the government deficit would disappear. Now, I don't hear that coming from the House Republicans. I don't hear that coming from the Tea Party. Everybody's saying government's too big and all that kind of stuff. Government has taken care of a lot of people over the years, disabled people, unemployed people, loans to kids to go to college, Medicaid, Medicare, that kind of stuff. It's helped people out, middle-class people, a lot.
Well, not just people.
You just cut the corporate tax loopholes in half, just in half. That would end the deficit.
Yep.
We're not even going to hear that discussed barely when we go into this craziness we're going to go into this fall.
Well, we're not going to hear it because you got companies like GE who didn't pay any taxes in 2010. Zero, zip, nothing in taxes. This huge multinational corporation, they just gave the shill group, Fix the Debt, $1 million that they're going to end up getting the tax credit for to tell us that we need to lower Social Security and destroy Medicare and destroy social spending. Because that's how we need to steal food out of the mouths of children to solve our debt problems.
Yeah, well, we have to get back from the shouting on each side and talk about something rational. I mean, people are living longer now. It is more expensive to pay for people's retirement. We've got to, fix that. But we got to fix it in a way that doesn't ruin people who are depending on Social Security for their retirement. You know, it's interesting. This simple COLA fix they're talking about, they call it the chain COLA, the cost of living adjustment that's made in Social Security every year.
Yeah.
They want to change the way that's calculated. For people in their 80s, single women in their 80s, that's going to cost them hundreds of dollars a month 20 years from now, and they're not going to have any other money. So we got to be careful in the way that we go. We have to be more sensible. We got to be more competitive than we have been. But we're given crazy tax breaks. The companies for moving, jobs overseas. We're giving them all kinds of other write-offs, and we're not rewarding the companies that are creating jobs here in Harrisburg and Pennsylvania, there are companies doing that.
Yeah.
If anybody deserves a tax break, they're the ones that do it for hiring veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, for generating new jobs, for generating new products, and building new plants instead of buying back company stock, which is what a lot of the big companies are doing right now. So we don't have a very smart, economically smart debate. Oh, you know, Rick, you have an audience out there that is largely a working class American. And what's interesting to me, and I get asked this everywhere I go when I go to make speeches about Who Stole the American Dream, the book I've written, people ask me, how come so many working class people buy the argument that you gotta lower the tax rates on the rich to let the economy go. You gotta let these companies do what they want. You gotta get the government out of the way. They got the government out of the way in the financial sector in the 80s and the 90s and 2000s. And what happened? We had a terrible crash, largely because we didn't have decent regulation. Nobody knew how to follow those things. In fact, J.P. Morgan, the head of J.P. Morgan, he can't even keep control of his own bank. It isn't just the regulators. But the question is, and you know your audience, they call in, they talk to you, why do you think people buy that idea?
Because all they hear.
It's really against their economic self-interest, and it's not helping the country. But
I would argue, Hedrick, it's all we hear. I mean, I go back to a story I talked about for the last couple of years. Florida State University gets $2 million a year from the Koch brothers. And for that $2 million, million with an M, the Koch brothers get veto power over all professors hired in their economics department. So do you think that they're going to hire anyone who talks about Keynesian economics? Do you think they're going to talk about anybody who has anything other than Chicago School laissez-faire free market economics? No, it's all we're told.
Well, there's a problem in the media because the Florida State University doesn't exactly swing the biggest stick academically in the country. I mean, there's Columbia
but they're not
and
the
Harvard
only one.
And Stanford and Yale and that kind of stuff. And there are a lot of economists coming out of some of those schools that are saying the same thing. But there are people. You mentioned Chris Van Hollen, Steny Hoyer, Carl Levin from Michigan, Bernie Sanders from Vermont. I mean, you got great guys from Rhode Island and Ohio. You got some good, smart senators saying, intelligent things. But out there in the country, there's still a very large group of people who are saying, yeah, get the government off their backs, let the rich people invest their money. What drives the economy is not that investment. What drives the economy is consumer purchasing power. I learned that in Economics 101, I hate to say more than 50 years ago, but I went to college. 70% of the driving force in any economy, any modern economy, is consumer purchasing power. We've got big companies now that are sitting on $2 trillion of investment money. They're using that money to buy back the stock in their own company, to run up the price of the stock, which gives the CEO a bigger bonus every year.
Yep.
And they're not building new plants. They're not buying new equipment. They're not hiring more workers. Why? Because there's not enough demand for bicycles and refrigerators and lawnmowers and all kinds of other things that we could make here in America. So we don't get that demand unless middle-class people get good pay. We have Caterpillar tractors. Last year, Caterpillar Tractors, a big earth equipment moving company, made $4.9 billion in profit. There was a strike by the unions at Caterpillar. They wanted an increase in pay. Caterpillar faced them down. The unions weren't strong enough. The workers went back to work. Caterpillar imposed a wage freeze. And then they found they had $4.9 billion in profits. Now, you know those profits went somewhere. They went to the CEO. They went to the top executives. They went to the shareholders. I mean, the workers should be getting half of that. Give half of it to the workers, fine. Give half of it to the shareholders. So, you've got a situation where companies are making money and the workers aren't benefiting. In the last four years, Rick, corporate profits have risen an average of 20.1% a year. That's more than 80% in 4 years. The median household income, the income of the average typical American working family, has gone up 1.4% a year. That total it all up, 6%. 6% versus 80%. Same picture we've had over the last 30 or 40 years. We have to wake up.
Yeah.
We have to wake up and not just pay attention when we vote in elections, but organize between elections to push the people in Washington to do what the middle class in America wants and needs and will help the country.
I'm right there with you. The book, Who Stole the American Dream, written by Hedrick Smith. I guess you can pick it up at his website, hedricksmith.com.
You can't buy the book at the website. You got to go to Amazon or a bookstore or get an audio book. I don't sell the books. I just write them.
Okay. Well, then we'll get a link.
No, but go to the website. There's lots of other stuff there. But if you want the book, and the paperback's just about to come out, and you can get a good discount from Amazon or whatever on the you can get a good discount even at your local bookstore, probably. Right,
we'll make sure that we make that available. Last question I've got for you. This weekend is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington by Dr. King and, you know, the Civil Rights Movement. The message that I'm hearing now that the right-wing media is pushing is that it's not what Dr. King would have wanted because, well, there are gays that are coming along. I'm curious what your thoughts of the march are and the history of it as well.
Well, the first thing I need to tell you, Rick, is I was there. I covered Martin Luther King in Albany, Georgia. I covered him in Birmingham with the police dogs and the fire hoses. I was there at the March on Washington. It was probably one of the most unbelievable days in my life as a reporter. And I covered Russia, Vietnam, Egypt, Middle East, all kinds of stuff, civil rights protests in the South. It was an amazing day. It was a day when all kinds of ordinary people, a couple hundred thousand ordinary people, most of them black, but a lot of whites as well, went to say we have to expand the boundaries of freedom in America and grant equal rights. But there was also an economic component to that. That was a march on Washington for jobs and freedom, both jobs and freedom. And Philip Randolph, who was probably the leading black labor organizer in America at that time, was really the chief organizer of the march, and he spoke about the need for jobs. He spoke about the need for better pay. So did some other people who spoke there. It was a great day. I don't remember anybody talking about gays or that being an issue at all. This is a distortion. What we had in that time was, I mentioned before, the civil rights movement. We had a strong labor movement that, by the way, that fought for and got 84% of the workers in companies with 100 or more employees had a lifetime pension from their employer. 84%.
Wow.
Lifetime pension, monthly check from the day you retired to the day you died. 70% had fully employer-paid health benefits. Today, the number is 18%. So there were real benefits that came out of the exercise of middle-class power. And to me, that's the lesson of the March on Washington for us today. Blacks achieved important gains with that march and with other protests in the streets. Labor unions achieved great gains for middle-class Americans, people who weren't in unions just as well as for people who were in unions, because they were able to bargain with GM, GE, IBM, DuPont, you name it, the big companies, U.S. Steel, Bethlehem, those companies, and those agreements became a model for non-union workers and non-union employers all across the country. You had to have good pay, you had to have good benefits in order to get and hold workers. So we got to get back to a fuller employment so that workers have the power to negotiate with these companies. Growth, jobs, that's the answer. It's critical. And people fighting for their own rights and banding together is very important. Middle class fighting for itself is absolutely critical. That is, in fact, what made the great heyday of the middle class in America. And if we want it back, we got to do it again. To me, that's the lesson of the March on Washington.
I'm right there with you. The book is Who Stole the American Dream? We've got a link over at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Hedrick Smith, his name. It'll take you right there. Hedrick, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time. We'd love to have you come back and talk to us again.
I will enjoy it anytime you want, Rick. Like to talk about these issues. They won't go away. By the way, I got a couple of... Give me an email, I'll ship you. I got a couple of very strong, interesting op-eds about who's got the right answer for the middle class today and how we got greater inequality during economic recovery right now. If you give me an email, I will send that along to you, and you can ship it around to your listeners.
I most certainly will. I'll get it to you during the break. Hedrick, thanks so much. Appreciate the time. Again, the book, Who Stole the American Dream?, written by Hedrick Smith. We'll get a link over at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Hedrick's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And take your money. All they want to do is.
listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The rich, as F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote, are different from you and me. But had F. Scott known Michael Dell, he would have added this corollary. The super rich are different from the merely rich. Dell, the computer magnate, is a preening peer of the multi-billionist corporate class. Thus, if any of our society's rules get in his way, he just changes them. Hey, he says, I'm super rich. I make my own rules. And that's what he's doing now in a power play against his own corporate shareholders. Earlier this year, he made a lowball bid to buy them out, fully expecting them to say, yes, sir. But as the July 18th date approached for shareholders to cast their ballots and rubber stamp Dell's bad deal, most were voting against him. So Mr. Super Rich simply had his board delay the vote to July 24th so he could wrangle some of those ornery owners of his company to his side. But oops, he was still losing when the 24th arrived, so he imperiously ordered Election Day moved again. One major stock owner decried the tyranny, exclaiming that this is not a banana republic. Oh, not only did El Jefe move the vote to September, but he actually directed the board to change the rules of voting to assure that this time he would win. Previously, shareholders who did not cast a ballot were considered to be against the deal. Now, their shares won't count at all. More significantly, the voter pool was expanded in Dell's favor by allowing speculators who bought shares as late as August 13th to cast ballots. This is Jim Hightower saying, the upshot is that King Michael will grab the multi-billion dollar corporation by imperial decrees that will stiff common shareholders who will lose millions of dollars. And that's how the rich get richer at the expense of the rest of us. It's easy, you see, when you get to make up the rules as you go along.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me because we're having a serious problem with that.
Go, go, go. I messed up my entire life go, because I got high. I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Say what, say what, say what, say what.
Now I'm sleeping on the sidewalk and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, yeah, because I got high. Because I got high. Because I got high.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So recently, CNN's Sanjay Gupta, he wrote an op-ed which It's been shared something like 500,000 times on Facebook, where he apologizes for his past opposition to medical marijuana, saying he regrets not studying the issue more closely and for believing the government's propaganda. Now, you look around the country, 20 states have medical marijuana laws, 16 have decriminalized possession, 2 states, Colorado and Washington, have actually legalized it. So the question is, are we rethinking it? Locally here, there's going to be a panel scheduled on Monday, May 30th, 6 p.m. over at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore, 1302 North 3rd Street here in Harrisburg. Mark Cohen, the sponsor of the legalization legislation, will be there along with John Eichelberger, an opponent of it. So the question is, do we have a change of heart on the pot front? Well, here to talk about it a little bit from the maybe not so much side is Dr. Kevin Sabat. He's the former senior advisor to President Obama's drug czar. Currently, Dr. Sabat is the director of drug policy, the Drug Policy Institute at Florida, the University of Florida, also co-founder of Project SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, as well as the co-author of Reefer Sanity, 7 Great Myths About Marijuana. Dr. Sabat, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on tonight, Rick.
So I got to be honest with you. I have never smoked marijuana. It's just something I never did. Not for any particular reason. Just it was not something that I was interested in. I personally believe it's a way that we can, by decriminalizing it, we don't put people in jail for doing things in their homes that affect nobody but them.
Right. Well, actually, people aren't in jail or prison for small amounts of marijuana. I mean, a recent study looked at state prisons and found less than 0.5% of people were even there for anything related to marijuana possession, even people that had large amounts that could have been for distribution. So, there's a lot of myths, and that's what my book, Reefer Sanity, 7 Great Myths About Marijuana, that's what it sort of goes through, some of these statistics. Another myth, you brought up Sanjay Gupta. Sanjay Gupta's, the headlines, if you just read the headlines saying he changed his mind on weed or I was lied to about marijuana, you'd think he was in favor of legalization, which is how many people spun it. But that couldn't be further from the truth. What Sanjay Gupta said was that, marijuana has medicinal value. We need to study it more. We need to deliver it in safe ways to people that really actually need it. And I have a hard time disagreeing with that. But we don't smoke morphine or smoke opium to get the effects of morphine. We don't need to smoke marijuana to get its potential medical effects. Let's turn it into a medication so we know what's in it with a standard dosage so you can get it at a pharmacy. So the issue of medical and legalization, I think, are very different, but they're often lumped in together.
Okay, so on the medical side, we can probably agree. I think there are glaucoma patients who benefit from it. There are cancer patients who benefit from it. There's a benefit medically. You agree, right?
With components in it, yes, but that doesn't mean that we would legalize cigarettes in order for people to get that benefit. Again, I don't tell people to go smoke opium or inject heroin when I want them to get the positive effects of morphine. So let's, we have a pill actually already available called Marinol, which is THC, but we can do better. There are other medications coming through the pipeline that I think will be even better. And, for people right now that can't wait for that research, I actually have been advocating for something I wouldn't have been able to say in government, which is that we need to enroll people who really, truly have a need into a special research program so they can get a tincture or an oil or something that makes them feel better. I think that's okay. But, the studies show that less than 2% in states with quote-unquote medical marijuana have cancer, glaucoma, HIV, MS, any terminal illness, ALS, I mean, on and on. The vast majority of people are 30-some-year-old white males with a history of drug abuse who report back pain. I mean, that's what this is about.
Well, what's wrong with people in their homes? If they so choose to smoke marijuana in their homes, what's the problem with that? Would you rather them drinking alcohol? Would you rather them doing? Because I got to be honest with you.
Yeah.
When I think of my alcoholic friends and my pothead friends,
right,
I'd much rather be around my pothead friends because the alcoholic kind of acts like an a-hole a lot of the time.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is again, I'm not talking about people in their home. That's the thing. People think that legalization is about, your freedom to get high after work a couple times a week, whenever you feel like it, when you don't drive, when you're not taking care of kids, et cetera. And I know that's the picture people have in their mind. But it, let me tell you what legalization is really about. Legalization is
Before you tell me that,
you
just said something that caught my attention. You said, people who aren't taking care of kids. Well, there was just a story within the last couple of weeks of a couple in Texas who their 1-year-old daughter's in bed sleeping. They're smoking a joint in the living room. The state of Texas takes their kid from them, and the kid ends up being murdered by the foster care. Why? Because the couple chose in their home, in the privacy of their home, to smoke marijuana.
Obviously, that's a horrible, situation, but I don't think anybody wants to be advocating for, kids to be in households where it's marijuana smoking or other drugs taking place. I mean, wouldn't justify,
Thing
that happened. I'm not going to dodge the alcohol thing. Let me tell you about alcohol, and then I'll go back to what I was talking about, what legalization is about, because I don't want to dodge that. It's a good question, a very fair question. Alcohol has a long, widespread history of accepted use in our culture, and widespread use dating back to the Old Testament in the middle, a long time ago, ancient Rome. Smoking marijuana from a widespread perspective, I'm talking about the vast majority of the population in the West, has not occurred. So really, if you could go back in time, most people, based on a public health perspective, actually would probably turn off that switch and not have alcohol. But you know what? It is here to stay. We're living with it. And we live with it, by the way, to our peril. We spend, for every dollar in taxes that we gain from alcohol or cigarettes for that matter, it costs us over $10 in social costs. Like you said, the violence, this driving, murder, etc. I mean, it contributes to criminal justice costs, by the way, in huge ways alcohol does. So I don't think we want to be basing any policy on what has happened with alcohol and tobacco. And moving back to my point earlier about what legalization is about, this is the problem. What do we have with alcohol and tobacco today, Rick? We have multi-billion-dollar conglomerates that exploit the disadvantage in young people, that deny harms, that promote pseudoscience in order to promote their bottom line, and they live off addiction. We know from economic studies that the alcohol industry, for example, they do not make their money off the person who drinks responsibly. They make their money off of the 10% of extremely heavy users.
Right.
And so they have every incentive to increase use. Why wouldn't that be the same with marijuana? We're going to have big marijuana like we had big tobacco lying to Americans for 50 years. I know people's image of legalization is, Woodstock and fun times and smoking in a basement and nothing going on and no problems. But the reality with American capitalism today is you're going to have the mass commercialization, the mass promotion and exploitation of young people and of the disadvantaged. Why are there 8 times as many liquor stores in black neighborhoods than white neighborhoods in this country? It's because they are exploited. And we're going to have the same thing with marijuana. So I just don't subscribe to this, hippy-dippy, wonderful picture of what legalization is about. It's much more sinister than we think.
No, I got to be honest with you. I don't want a Pfizer or Merck or Big Pharma screwing with pot, because if you don't believe it's addictive now, once they get their hands on it, it will be uber addictive.
Well, and we know today's marijuana is about 5 to 6 times, depending on the area you're looking at, or even up to 10 times, stronger than the marijuana of the 60s, 70s, or 80s. So most people's experience with the marijuana is of moderate THC levels. THC is what gets you high. Now we have THC upwards on average of 15%, but you have much higher than that. And you have the other components in marijuana, which actually take the high away, and doctors think really that's where a lot of the medical values at. We have those components being bred out of modern marijuana because they don't make you high and they ruin the product. So we have more addictive marijuana. Exactly what your point. Imagine what multi-billion-dollar corporations would do to manipulate that even more and make it more of an addictive substance. It's just, I don't see what benefit we get. I don't think we should throw people in jail for small amounts. I agree with you. We need to harness the medical applications. Fine. But why is it either or? Why do we have to legalize in order to do that as opposed to taking more and more sensible measures?
So you're in favor of perhaps decriminalizing it? Because I got to be
honest. I hate the word decriminalized because you know what it means and I know what it means. But in most of the media, again, it's such a confusing, hot topic. People think it's equivalent to legalization. And I do think that people that are using marijuana habitually, it is a problem. It's a health problem. It's not just something that we should turn the other way or slap them with a $100 fine. I mean, some people need treatment for it. In fact, the number one reason kids need treatment today is for marijuana. So let's not belittle the public health harms. It can also be harmful for some people, not everyone,
right,
but for some people.
But, you know, my problem is I got to be honest. The war on drugs to me was stupid,
right.
And just
right.
Say No was even dumber. And putting pot, I got to be honest, putting pot as a Schedule I drug alongside
right.
of heroin or LSD or ecstasy,
right.
or any of those other things, just seems, well, just dumb to me.
Well, the issue is the war on drugs is a horrible analogy. It's a horrible term. I agree with you. We don't have a war on our own people. It doesn't make much sense at all from a policy perspective. The issue about scheduling, you know, everyone's so caught up with scheduling, which is amazing to me because scheduling is really a sort of archaic legal technical term that Congress came up with 40 years ago to essentially give different classes of drugs. So marijuana, the only reason it's in Schedule I is because smoked raw marijuana doesn't have medical purposes, and it has a high potential for abuse. And the issue is, even if it was Schedule II, it wouldn't be legal. So everyone who says, oh my God, we need to reschedule marijuana, that's fine, but given the legal definition of Schedule II even, it wouldn't be legal, and in fact, it wouldn't even be allowed medicinally. You have to have an FDA-approved product. The FDA has said over and over, we're not going to approve a product like smoked marijuana, which has unknown composition, unknown characterization and potency, depending on what kind of marijuana you're smoking, et cetera, and a delivery system that is unacceptable. We don't smoke any medicine. I don't care what it is. So that's why it's Schedule I. But products based on marijuana can be prescribed. They can go through the process. Some have already. And I think, you know, you and I would agree we need to further that process even more. And the government needs to step up and do that. And I've been a critic of the government in terms of the medical part of this. So we do need to advance that research more. But we don't need to smoke marijuana in order to do that.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Dr. Kevin Sabat. He's the former senior advisor to President Obama's drug czar, also the author of the book Reefer Sanity, Seven Great Myths About Marijuana. You know, for me, I look at this and I say, you know, I see the argument that, you know, maybe we make a product out of this and we tax it because, look, people are going to do it whether it's legal or illegal. Prohibition on alcohol didn't work.
Sure.
There's part of me that goes, you know, with some of our budget problems, this is a possibility.
Yeah.
And then maybe you end some of the drug cartels and some of the fighting and take the incentive out of it. I'm curious your thoughts.
Okay. Couple things. Drug cartels aren't making the vast majority of their money from marijuana, to be very clear. They're making their money from expensive drugs that we don't produce here in the United States. That would be cocaine and heroin. They're also making their money from methamphetamine, but they're really making a lot of money from kidnapping, extortion, political crimes, all kinds of things that has nothing to do or very little to do with marijuana. So I just don't see the cartels turning into, you know, ice cream men if marijuana was legalized. If we want to get rid of the cartels, we got to do some major reorganization of the institutions in countries like Mexico and Central America in terms of education, healthcare, workers' rights, housing. All of those things need to happen in order for that black market and anything to go away. So that, again, very simplistic solution to that. I know people think that it's a wonderful magic bullet, but it really is nothing but fantasy. In terms of tax revenue, again, alcohol and cigarettes are instructive. For every dollar, it costs us 10 in social costs. So, again, with marijuana, we're going to have more users if it's legal because it's commercialized, normalized. Right now, 7% of Americans smoke marijuana regularly versus 27% for cigarettes, 52% for alcohol. So even if we don't get as close to cigarettes or alcohol, let's just say we double the number of users. So it's 14% of Americans, which is still half of smokers of cigarettes. 14% means a lot more addiction. It means a lot more health care costs. I just don't see this as a net benefit. Again, you're right. People are going to – always people will be using drugs. I'm not living in a fantasy of we're going to get to 100%, you know, 0% use of drugs. I'm not living in that world. But we want to be able to try and reduce the number, not increase the number with our policies.
Yeah, I got to be honest. You know, I've got friends who, you know, they've got their little plant, and it's, you know, they're like criminals. You know, I've got my little plant in my backyard. And my view on it is they shouldn't have to worry about that.
The issue is they worry about it when it's more, you know, something comes to light where that's found. Again, you know, there's studies have been done. The chance of arrest per joint smoked is minuscule. It's like one arrest for every 12,000 joints, and arrest doesn't even equal jail. Arrest usually means nothing more than a parking ticket. So, you know, I agree. We don't want to over-criminalize. I don't want to give an 18-year-old kid a criminal record that's going to follow him till he's 30, you know, for having a joint in his pocket that was found when, you know, the cop pulled him over for speeding. I mean, I agree. You shouldn't ruin a kid's life because of that. But, again, that's very different than what is being promoted now of legalization, which really is the commercialization and the promotion of this, which isn't going to help anybody but big business in the long run.
All right. The book Reefer Sanity, 7 Great Myths About Marijuana, written by Dr. Kevin Sabat. Dr. Sabat, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
This was fun. Thanks, Rick. Take care.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at therickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice in the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
In fact, I was in a meeting in Wall Street, Rick, and it was a pretty stunning meeting because we were talking with them about, you know, how can we get more private investment in infrastructure? And they said, pay us. And you have to pay us not just the cost of the capital, like, you know, $60 million to rebuild I-80, you got to pay us for the profit that we would lose by putting that money elsewhere.
Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you got questions, comments, you can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or you can send me an email, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Evidently, according to the email I just got from Randall, Brett, the bumper music a bit too loud. You just woke his neighbors. Nice job. Anyway, you know, I go back and I'm taking a beating over the last interview. So the emails just came flooding in. Basically saying, you know, the guy's pulling stats out of his tuchus. One guy writes, you know, another person says that, you know, the majority of most drug overdoses are from pharmaceuticals. Why is it any of his business what other people are doing? You know, another email asked me why I didn't ask him whether he drinks or not. Says he doesn't like being preached to by guys like him. And look, I don't like being preached to either. I got to be honest, and for, you know, for perfect clarification, I've never smoked pot. I bought the, as a young kid growing up in the projects, I bought, and I think it was my mother, more than anything, it was my mother who basically said, "I catch you doing drugs, I'll kill you." The Bill Cosby, "I brought you in, I'll take you out" mentality. And, you know, I've seen people, I shouldn't say people, I saw one person. Dead on the side of the neighbor's house with a needle in their arm. So very intimately, I equated drugs with death. Am I wrong in saying that pot is in that? Yes. I now understand. Yeah, that was probably wrong. Which is why I did ask the question about the Schedule I drugs. Because putting pot next to heroin, no. And this idea that you know, we can't find employees because they can't pass a drug test. You know, as we were talking about that, I was remembering back to, I think it was May when Governor Corbett said that, you know, one of his big concerns is that nobody could pass a drug test. That's why there are all these unemployed. Other than the fact that, you know, there are 3 unemployed people for every available job. And the more jobs governor has, well, more than Wyoming, hasn't passed any policy to create jobs in the state. The fact of the matter is drug testing experts said back in May that there were fewer workers testing positive for drugs and drug tests than the country as a whole here in Pennsylvania. So that's kind of ridiculous. And it's amazing to me how the Chamber of Commerce and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association and all of the business groups jumped on it. Yeah, we're not hiring because there are people who are drug addicts, which is ridiculous. Now look, I'm kind of in the middle on this. I'm the libertarian in me, and this is where I guess I'll explain this, because I think this is a discussion that has to be had, because I think there is a push to legalize it, and my fear, understand my fear in this, is that we put this on the shelf, and this is right there next to the jack, and next to the snuff, to all of this different stuff. And it's marketed, and it's sold at high rates, and it's tweaked, and it's engineered to where now it's super addictive. And look, when Big Pharma gets a hold of it, and this is my fear in legalizing, I'm in favor of decriminalizing. Look, if you got a little pot plant in your backyard and it's for your personal consumption, what do I care? Because the libertarian in me says, you know what do I care what you do within the confines of your four walls? Do whatever you want to do. You've got the right to do whatever you want. Or as Justice Black says, you've got the right to flail your fists around until your fist touches the tip of my nose. You've got the right to do whatever you do until it affects me. There's that part of me. And I say it should be decriminalized. I'm not, the distinction between decriminalizing and legalizing and marketing, and that's the part that gets me. It's the marketing part. There's part of me goes, yeah, hey, you know, we can maybe tax it. People will use it, we'll tax it, we'll control it like we try to do with cigarettes. Teen smoking is down. Might be good. I don't know. It's a conversation worth having. It's a conversation I think that's important to be had. But at the end of the day, I still don't think you lock people up. And the reason I brought the story up of the kid, of the parents and the little girl in Texas is because that's the kind of insanity that goes on. When just a little bit. Now, I go back to the fact that, I never used it. Because I did believe that it was the gateway. It led to the next thing. Is that possible? Sure. For some, I'm sure it does. I guess everybody picks their nose. Only a handful of people actually eat what they pick, right? And so I guess the same thing is true there. My fear was, knowing myself, and this is where I think individuals have to be a little smarter and understand themselves. I've got an addictive personality. I'm sure if I started smoking pot, I'd be the best pothead ever. I'm sure then that would move on to the next one, and I'd be the best cokehead ever, the best heroin addict. Or I'd be the guy that we found dead on the side of the house. So it's a question of, where does it lead? As I said, I'm in favor of decriminalizing. I'm a little leery of corporatizing, and I don't know that there's anybody who could argue with me. And I'd love to hear the argument of why we should hand this over to corporate America. Because that's what's going to happen. And that's where legalization, I think, takes us. I think big pharma figures out, how we put it in vending machines and make it super addictive. I guess that's always been my position. I fear the big corporate capitalist. I fear that. Because if they get a hold of it, well, I guess maybe the tax revenue, though. Interesting. I've taken a beating over this, and I knew I would. I understand, he's a guy who's kind of saying, you better think about it. And he was the special assistant to the drug czar, which I got to wonder if, he had any of the things that he said about the war on drugs, if he said any of that to the people there, to the official drug czar. I kind of wonder, but I look at some of the myths that he threw out, and he wrote one of the myths is that marijuana is harmless and not addictive, and I don't think anybody believes that it's completely harmless. I don't know that anybody really believes that it's non addictive. Everything has a quality that could be. Soda. I am a soda addict. I've tried to quit a number of times. It's almost as hard as when I quit after a number of years dipping snuff. Here I am. It's been 15 years since I gave up smokeless tobacco. And, every once in a while, I still jones for it. Should we do away with that? Some people say we probably should. But for me, there are a lot of medicinal qualities. I think, I just think, the personal use issue, decriminalize it. That simple. Anyway, if you've got any thoughts on it, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I love the beatings. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk. But after all, something as simple as rock and roll would save us all. Now who'd have thought that after all, it was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Fast food and retail workers who went on strike in seven U.S. cities are calling for a nationwide day of strikes August 29th. It's part of the fight for $15 an hour, and the right to organize unions without employer intimidation. Terrence Wise, a 34-year-old father of three who earns $9.30 an hour after 8 years at a Burger King, is urging fast food and low-wage workers nationwide to join the growing low-wage worker movement with strikes on August 29th. Two straight weeks of daily arrests for singing protest songs without a permit at Wisconsin's Capitol, and the people participating in the Solidarity Sing-Along remain unintimidated. This is what it sounded like Tuesday as Governor Scott Walker's Capitol cops continue to arrest peaceful singers and to shove reporters trying to record the arrests.
I'm dissenting against the policies of this administration.
I'm recording events, that's all I'm doing.
Back up.
I'm recording events, that's all I'm doing. I'm a credentialed reporter.
There's a quote at the end of episode 3 of Eyes on the Prize. It hurt Pee Wee more than it hurt me. May they learn to live by their consciences.
What's your name? I'm a reporter, I'm doing my job.
D. Lemke. My dad's here with me. I hope he's not disappointed.
The people!
It's fun! Come try it!
Be defeated! The people! United!
It's recorded.
The Office and Professional Employees International Union is adding 2,000 workers to its ranks. The Independent Union of Telephone Workers in Puerto Rico has decided to affiliate with OPEIU. The new workers' union will be OPEIU Local 1971. Auto manufacturing is ground to a halt in South Africa as auto workers press for higher wages. Jesse Russell reports.
Port Elizabeth, South Africa is known as the Detroit of Africa for its high concentration of auto plants. Most of the major vehicle manufacturers have plants in the port city, and they're all facing strike action. An estimated 30,000 auto workers have been walking the picket lines since Monday, seeking a 14% wage increase. The automakers have offered an 8% wage increase. The United States is the largest importer of vehicles manufactured in Port Elizabeth, but the vehicles are exported to 148 countries around the globe. The auto industry is so important to South Africa's economy that it amounts for 12% of the country's exports. Toyota, Volkswagen, General Motors, Ford, and Mercedes-Benz all have plants in the country. Workers are represented by the National Union of Metal Workers, and the union has said the strike will intensify if a compromise can't be reached.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In the end, Wall Street, with Obama, Duncan, Bloomberg, Wolcott, and Goldstein as its agents, they want to turn public education into private, profitable businesses. They hope to impose factory regime of managerial control over educators' working conditions and our students, our children's learning conditions.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Another email came in. That guy drove me crazy. Now a more rational solution. Don't allow corporations to be part of the process. He writes, look at the Netherlands. Pot is legal, but no more major corporations are part of the picture. Allow people to grow for themselves as they are able to brew beer and wine. And look, I got to be honest, I'm in favor of that. You know, you in your backyard have a little plot. You want to grow yours, and you use it for yourself. You're not out there hocking out on the corner, the kids at the local school. I'm okay with that. Leave it alone. Problem is I don't believe that's what happens in this country. We are not the Netherlands. This is a country controlled by moneyed interests. And, you know, I gotta be honest, as much as I would like that to be the case, it's just, I wish we could have that kind of control. We don't. We don't have that kind of active, engaged, and informed electorate. We don't have people who, you know, earlier on we were talking with Hedrick Smith, the guy who wrote the book, Who Stole the American Dream. And, you know, I think that the key to take from that interview is something we've talked about many times on this program. And look, his book, which is fantastic, is basically what we've been talking about on this program for years. We need to have a working class that's active and engaged. We need to have a working class that takes to the streets, like this weekend, the March on Washington, the 50th anniversary of King going to Washington, and the march that went on there for a fair economy. I mean, now we're looking at inequality that's worse than it was then. So as I look at this, I go, you know, there's so much we should be engaged in, so much we should be pursuing, so much activity we should be fighting for. And, you know, at the end of it, it's us, it's you, it's me, in the streets, calling our elected officials, voting for people who aren't insane. Anyway, we've been following this case with Peabody Coal, or Peabody Energy. Turns out, I got a press release from the United Mine Workers today that said that the appellate bankruptcy court has overturned the decision allowing Peabody Energy to stop paying for health care benefits for 3,100 retirees. According to the press release, the United Bankruptcy Court of the Eighth Circuit reversed the decision of the federal bankruptcy judge, Kathy Surrogate States. Now Peabody's going to have to pay, which I think is a huge win. They wrote in the press release, the strongly worded decision by the three-judge panel means that Peabody continues to hold responsibility for paying for the health care benefits of this group of retirees, mostly in the Midwest. Now, as we've been talking about, what happened is, for those who may not remember, Peabody created this Patriot Coal Company. And there are those who believe, and I tend to be one of them, who believe that that company was set up specifically to move these retirees into, to saddle with liabilities, spin off so that they die. You go through bankruptcy, you shed all of those legacy costs, you know, those pensions for workers. You kick those people to the curb, and voila, you're fresh and clean. And it's something companies have been doing for at least a generation, even more. You spin off a company, you saddle it with a bunch of debt, you cut it off, bankruptcy, boom, it's done. On the back of the PBGC, taxpayers pick up the thing, and the CEO goes, hey, look at us, we made a nice profit, more money for us. The problem was is those companies were generally going out of business anyway. They were spiraling down. Peabody Energy is an extremely profitable company. And from what I've been told and what I've read is this is like one of the first times a very profitable company chose to do this specifically just because they could. So I think this is a huge decision. This is Herculean. This is one of those moments where you go, there might be a chance. There might be a chance that workers might get a fair shot. Because, you know, we've gone to a number of these rallies where, you know, you look at these folks who are, look, you know, they've given their lives to coal mining. Their bodies are broken. Their lungs are shot. The majority of them couldn't even walk up a couple of flights of stairs. And this company wanted to take their health care, which was guaranteed to them for life in an agreement back in the 40s. Because we understood that, look, you go down to the mines, expect to live a decade less. Expect to live the end of your life with a lower quality of living. And when we were in Fairmont, West Virginia for the last rally that we attended back at the beginning of July, I was taken by the number of people you see walking around with oxygen bottles, the number of people walking around with canes, and the number of people hunched over. And these are not, you know, people in their 80s and 90s, people in their 50s and 60s. So good for this judge. I mean, it gives me hope that there's a possibility. But now my question is, what penalties? I mean, shouldn't there be? Yeah, I think about yesterday we talked about the woman up in, I forget what county, the Bald Eagle State Park, who stole $15,000. She's going to go to jail. There's no question about that. And then the hedge fund manager who misappropriated it, $133 million. He'll pay an $18 million fine. Don't worry about it. He paid a fine. We'll slap on the wrist. He admitted he did wrong. He won't do it again. Why isn't Peabody Coal going to be held, I think, criminally responsible for this? Why aren't there penalties? I mean, think about it. If corporations want to be people, shouldn't we be able to lock them up? Shouldn't we be able to throw away the key? Because this was done with malice and forethought. This was willful. This was premeditated. But I guess we don't think that way when we think about these big, huge multinational corporations. Oh, no, Rick. They're benevolent companies. They care. Uh-huh. Kind of like GE. They care so much that they gave the fix the debt people $1 million. That of course we're gonna subsidize. Thank you very much as taxpayers, because they'll be able to write that off. A company that paid no taxes in 2010, no federal taxes in 2010, making them one of the 47% that Mitt Romney tried to disgrace during the 2012 election. Was he talking about? Gee, of course not. So what should be the penalty? Should we hold them accountable? I say yes. Sadly, our system's not going to do it. And the fact that JP Morgan Chase gave $500,000 to fix the debt. Now, these are the people who really brought our economy to its knees. And we're rewarding them with a system that allows them to launder money through. Money that we could be using for education. Money that we could be using for health care. Money that we could be using to improve our infrastructure. That we could be investing in tomorrow. We're selling off our future so that these corporate titans and today's robber barons can have just a little bit more. And I guess, and as I've said before, I guess there's some national pride in knowing that we have the largest class of billionaires in the world. I guess there's pride in that. Even as we're closing elementary schools, and even as we're a nation with, 50 million people uninsured, some 100 million people underinsured. But at least we've got the billionaires, right? And at least we've got, an extremely well-funded Congress. And I look to, the ISAs of the world. You did know Darrell Issa was named the wealthiest guy in Congress. The guy who's trying to destroy the post office and succeeding and doing very well at it. Thank you very much. A guy who, it just leaves me scratching my head. Anyway, gonna take a quick break. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And they're talking in the town square, and they're talking, shouting. I hear them talking everywhere, they're talking never stops. But all their words are whispering, won't make you go away. Hey, the cold's the back you're down, and nothing left to say.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Investor class, diving through attack shelters.
every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Please check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So an interesting story out in San Francisco. Yesterday, about 150 students and activists sat in at I guess it was City Hall there, protesting the theft of an accreditation of the City College there, which is one of the big community colleges. Which statistically, I saw this number that 54% of the voters in San Francisco, either they or a family member has attended this college, the City College of San Francisco, which is wildly popular, and I guess it's making its way, but somebody's not happy with it. Here to help us work through this and find out what's going on is Lalo Gonzalez. He's a student at the City College of San Francisco and also a senator in the student government there at the City College of San Francisco. Lalo, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me on here.
So what's going on?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot. I guess I'll backtrack. As of last year, last summer, summer 2012, the ACCJC, which is the Accreditation Commission, issued our school, basically put us on sanction with the show cause, which is the heaviest of sanctions, basically skipping multiple steps. Instead of putting us on probation, first it went straight to show cause, kind of a way to intimidate the school and force them to follow their agenda, which is these 14 recommendations imposed on our school, saying that we must follow these 14 recommendations or else we lose accreditation. And without accreditation, it means that we will no longer be able to get financial aid, federal assistance, and the classes will no longer be transferable and usable to go to another institution. And so it's a huge way to intimidate a school. And so basically administration, along with the Board of Trustees, was working in that favor to basically trying to go through with the accreditation process. The problem is that if you look at those 14 recommendations, what it does is basically it's an agenda, a model to downsize City College. And it's had very drastic and negative impacts for the working class community, especially around San Francisco. And specifically, it disproportionately affects people of color. You have, like, major cuts to, for instance, CSPS, Students with Disabilities, EOPS Second Chance, which provides a lot of resources for ex-offenders to go back to school straight out of prison. You have huge hits to diversity studies, such as women's studies, Latino studies, African-American studies, LGBTQ studies, Philippine studies, all those on the chopping block right now. We've had dozens of faculty laid off. We've had 48 counselors laid off. We've had significant downsizing and restructuring in our governance. So, for instance, they eliminated student input and basically hired more administrators to make the decision-making, saying that student input and faculty input was actually creating barriers for the decision-making process. And so in order to do that, they actually, the ACCJC, well, Bryce Harris, the state chancellor, along with San Francisco's mayor, Ed Lee, they imposed a special trustee, Bob Agrella, who at first had veto power over our board of trustees. But as of this summer, the ACCJC said that we had not made significant progress and therefore said that our school will effectively close as of next summer unless we show that we make even more progress, which actually translates into more cuts. And so what Ed Lee and Bryce Harris decided to do is actually give Bob Agrella even more power, and they liquidated the democratically chosen board of trustees and turned Bob Agrella into a super trustee, which is basically a dictator over the entire school and has all decision-making power without anyone's input. And everything is done behind closed doors now. And so yesterday, students held a rally outside of City Hall to protest Ed Lee and demanding him that he follows two of our demands, one of them being that he calls basically an end to all sanctions and immediate cancellation of all sanctions against CCSF, as well as the immediate firing of Bob Agrella and the end of the dictatorship of the special trustee. But just to backtrack a little bit as well, the Department of Education actually issued a decision on a complaint that our faculty union, AST 2121, along with CFT, California Federation of Teachers, filed a nearly 300-page complaint against the ACCJC, saying that the process had a lot of issues, and the Department of Education just came down with the ruling a couple weeks ago saying that they agreed that there were some major issues along that major violations of federal regulation on the part of the ACCJC, and it revolved around some critical points, such as there's a conflict of interest. That conflict of interest was Barbara Bino, which is the president of the ACCJC, this accreditation commission. Her husband served on one of the evaluation teams that evaluated CCSF.
You're kidding.
On top. What was that?
You're kidding. I guess it's a small world, right?
Yeah, right. And so, and on top of that as well is that the ACCJC had one of their staff personnel also on one of the evaluation teams, even though there was no policy that said that they could do that. On top of that, there was inadequate representation of faculty within those evaluation teams. One of the federal regulations says that you're supposed to have at least, well, it says adequate representation, but what they're trying to say about half. But what you actually saw is on these teams of 8 and 16, you actually only had one faculty member on each. So out of that 8, you only had one, and out of the 16, you had only one faculty, and the rest were administrators, basically giving you a very, very biased evaluation of the school. And so along with that, there was so basically it validated our concerns that we have been spreading for the past year, saying that the ACCJC is completely out of control. It's a rogue institution. If you look at the statistics, it actually clearly shows and it demonstrates that the ACCJC has actually went overboard and has actually sanctioned out-of-control community college throughout the state. In fact, if you look, if you compare it, I think it's about 67% of the sanctions throughout the entire nation have stemmed from the ACCJC by itself. That's remarkably larger than any other accreditation commission. And so ever since Barbara Bino had taken reins in this accreditation commission, it's been completely out of control. And so it's very important, if you actually look at those recommendations, it has nothing to do with quality of education, which is specifically what this accreditation commission is supposed to look at.
Right.
In fact, what it's actually looking at is basically giving you a model to downsize and follow basically a downsizing structure that fits this privatizing maneuver that basically is an epidemic stemming around the entire country.
Yeah, I mean, because if you're willing to, as I understand it, it's like $46 a credit hour there, right?
Yeah, it is now.
And if you can destroy it, maybe you can raise those credit hours and make a little bit of money. I mean, as you're laying this out for me, this sounds like a page right out of the Broad Foundation or any of these right wing. Education, quote unquote, reform groups who are trying to privatize K-12 education. Sounds like a play right out of their book.
No, definitely. I mean, in fact, if you look at this state specifically, they rather fund, they actually rank number one in prison funding, but actually rank 47 for K-12 funding. And then for higher education, they rank number 48. So what you actually see at CCSF and throughout the entire state is a political choice to actually defund public education. And so you have a basically downsizing public education and steering towards private colleges and charter schools where privatizers and corporations could actually make money and make students into commodities.
So what's the pushback? I mean, when I saw the statistic, 54% of the people in the area, had either gone there or knew somebody that went there. What's the pushback? I mean, there've got to be people who are livid.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, this entire community is in disbelief. You know, at first we basically created a coalition. It's called the Safe CCSF Coalition, which consists of predominantly it's students as well as faculty members. And now, you know, we have the support of the union as well, who's now also calling for the reversal of all sanctions placed on this school. And so it's, this movement is definitely growing. And after yesterday's protest, it's definitely galvanized a lot of students who are now willing to be much more basically mobilized even more. We're actually holding a general assembly tomorrow, and we're expected to see hundreds of students there. But we've been organizing for months now. We've held plenty of actions. They've been extremely successful. The biggest problem right now is that the lack of transparency coming from Bob Agrella, and this the basically trying to sell this vision that they're trying to help students out, that this is for the better of the institution, that they're going to make this institution even stronger by the time this accreditation process is over. But which you actually look at Bob Agrella's track record, and actually if you look at on the ground, what's actually occurring is actually you're seeing a systematic people of color systematically being taken out of CCSF, and even more so low-income students. They just imposed this new pay or get dropped policy on our school, and basically says that if you don't have the money right away to pay for the school, you will get dropped. And if you look at undocumented students who don't have access to financial aid and don't have access to many scholarships, they're basically left in the dark to have to pay right out of their pockets, and most of them cannot afford so. And so I had the opportunity to speak to an administrator about this specific issue. And when she looked at me after I questioned her, and she looked at me for about 15 seconds and tells me, well, honestly, we're going to have to make some sacrifices. And unfortunately, not that many students will be able to come to this school.
Wow.
So basically what she's saying is that social justice is no longer acceptable at this school, that accessibility equity is no longer a priority for this institution, that which has historically been open to the community. The only community college in San Francisco. I mean, it's what makes the entire city go round. If you actually look at the statistics for CCSF, it gives the workers straight into, it pumps them right into the economy here at San Francisco. It's a major resources for a lot of different communities, specifically Latino community, where they have their own campus there as well. It's completely sad. I was in disbelief. I was in shock. You know, I talked once to also the vice chancellor who's interim there. They put her here specifically to work around this issue. And she even said, we sat down, it was a few student organizers, and after we had occupied the administration building, she sat down with us. We were able to get a meeting with her, and she said that, quote, I don't believe in equity. And, you know, and it's, it's so hard to believe that, you know, you would hear those words come out of these people who are saying that they're trying to help the school out, and when they actually go out in front of everyone else, they're trying to put on a show saying that what they're trying to do is actually help students, when in reality they're not.
Yeah, I don't know how closing the school and taking their accreditation does anything. And now, academically, I mean, because I was under the impression the only way you could pull someone's accreditation is if they weren't meeting the standards academically. But what you're telling me is that's not the case, that 110,000 students are going to lose access to local, state, and federal funding when this accreditation is being stripped away, and it's not for academic reasons.
No, not at all. In fact, Nick, I already went over some of the issues, but, you know, they in fact, the ACCJC has actually said, their evaluation team have actually said that the quality of education is outstanding, it's excellent, superior compared to other schools. And there's actually statistics that prove that as well. New York Times actually ranked City College of San Francisco as one of the top schools in the nation. We've been known as one of the most unique schools that offer plenty of resources and classes, specific classes that not many other institutions offer. We were the first school to implement LGBTQ studies. We were the first institution to implement Filipino studies. So we've actually been, you know, doing some really great work. Unfortunately, this accreditation commission, that's not what they're focusing on. They're looking at actually other issues and issues that have nothing to do with quality of education, financial stability, saying that the school is cannot support being accessible to all these students, saying that they have to shrink or else they're no longer going to, you know, basically that we're not going to be able to be as accessible given that the state is no longer going to be able to provide much resources for us. Now, it's really important to note that financial stability, the school isn't financially stable. It's that in the future, it's not going to be financially stable because the ACCJC is also linked to the Obama and the Department of Education's whole, their move to kind of push away towards privatizing colleges, privatizing schools, K-12 and so forth. So there's a huge national push to do so. So it's really scary when they're not looking at quality of education. I mean, like what?
Right.
It's almost like we're almost like left to fend for ourselves. And so this pushback, it's gaining momentum. We're definitely pushing back as hard as possible. A lot of students are getting involved. It's looking really great, and so we're just hoping that it continues building.
Two quick questions. Is it possible to get another accreditation? There are a number of accreditation agencies out there. Is it possible to get another one of them? And then the second question is, what can we do to help?
Yeah, you know, that's it's an interesting question. So the ACCJC, the interesting thing is that it's actually going up for contract renewal this fall. And the Department of Education, after it actually gave its decision saying that it violated federal regulations, also put the ACCJC basically on their own show cause, saying if you don't fix these issues within the next 12 months, then we will strip you of your license, of your contract, or we will not even renew it this upcoming fall, which is a huge victory for us as well if that does happen. Now, as far as like what will happen if they do that, it's kind of left unclear. But they said that it doesn't affect the sanction at all. But as we know that it can change if we actually the mass mobilization and then a huge pushback that stems from students and from faculty. If we're able to create enough pressure, political pressure against Ed Lee and state representatives, that we know for sure that we'll be able to force the Department of Education to step in and actually do something about it. As far as like what people can do, I know this is happening everywhere throughout the country. Specifically, there's a couple petitions actually. If people go on SaveCCSS.org, there's a couple petitions that people can actually sign up on. And it's one that is calling for the reversal of the sanctions. There's one that's also calling for the ACCJC for the Department of Education to step in.
Right.
And so those are petitions that people outside of the Bay Area can get involved.
And we'll make sure we get those linked at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Lilo Gonzalez's name; it'll take you right there. Lilo, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much, and keep up the fight, and we'd love to hear how this continues and where this goes in the next coming days.
All right, yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. You know, I got an email during the break from Jackie who points out, you know, wouldn't it be nice if you had this crazy idea of fully funding schools and make prisons make up their budget with deficits with box tops and money from Target? Wouldn't that be a great idea? Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Homeless or the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The rich, as F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote, are different from you and me. But had F. Scott known Michael Dell, he would have added this corollary. The super rich are different from the merely rich. Dell, the computer magnate, is a preening peer of the multibillionous corporate class. Thus, if any of our society's rules get in his way, he just changes them. Hey, he says, I'm super rich. I make my own rules. And that's what he's doing now in a power play against his own corporate shareholders. Earlier this year, he made a lowball bid to buy them out, fully expecting them to say, yes, sir. But as the July 18th date approached for shareholders to cast their ballots and rubber stamp Dell's bad deal, most were voting against him. So Mr. Super Rich simply had his board delay the vote to July 24th so he could wrangle some of those ornery owners of his company to his side. But oops, he was still losing when the 24th arrived, so he imperiously ordered Election Day moved again. One major stock owner decried the tyranny, exclaiming that this is not a banana republic. Oh, not only did El Jefe move the vote to September, but he actually directed the board to change the rules of voting to assure that this time he would win. Previously, shareholders who did not cast a ballot were considered to be against the deal. Now, their shares won't count at all. More significantly, the voter pool was expanded in Dell's favor by allowing speculators who bought shares as late as August 13th to cast ballots. This is Jim Hightower saying, the upshot is that King Michael will grab the multi-billion dollar corporation by imperial decrees that will stiff common shareholders who will lose millions of dollars. And that's how the rich get richer at the expense of the rest of us. It's easy, you see, when you get to make up the rules as you go along.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
This is one of those moments where my head is about to explode. And this is where you go, stupid. Hey, stupid. According to the public policy polling people, they conducted a survey of Louisiana Republicans. 29% of the Louisiana Republicans believe Obama was more to blame for the response to Hurricane Katrina than George W. Bush was. 44% said they were unsure who was more responsible. This tells me that 73% of those Republicans polled in Louisiana, are stupid. Obama was a freshman in the Senate in 2005. And this is in their backyard. Absolutely, completely mind-blowing. Oh, man. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C., find out what's going on there and around the world. I got Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, what do you think? 73% of Louisiana Republicans, not the brightest bulbs in the box.
Wow. I was listening to you. Wow.
29%. All I can say is wow. 29% think Obama's more to blame than Bush.
I mean, I'm more to blame than Obama. I mean, at least I was in Congress at the time. He wasn't even in the Congress.
Oh,
wow.
Geez. You know, it's just, well, okay.
It's bizarre.
Anyway, the big news today, obviously, Private Manning sentenced 35 years in jail. I don't know that anybody is happy about this. The people who wanted to see him hang because he's treasonous, they didn't really get the satisfaction that they wanted. People like me who said, you know what, 3 years of torture is enough. Let him go. I'm not happy with it. What are your thoughts?
Well, it could have been time served, as far as I'm concerned with him. But there were people who wanted the whole 90 years.
Yeah.
And I think that something was going to happen. It was more than I thought it would be. But then again, you know, judicial affairs are political affairs too in some cases, and then it makes it easier to go after other people that are whistleblowers. It sends a chilling message, just like the detaining of the partner of Greenwald, Miranda. It sends a message. These are messages sent, and that's what I think happened with Manning. The guy was cleared on aiding and abetting the enemy. After that, honestly, and you know this, Rick, as well as I do, the best anybody could come up with is, what, 2 or 3 years? Because he didn't aid and abet the enemy.
Yep.
So, yeah, this wouldn't now, he would have an eligibility of parole in 8 years, and I would honestly predict, I think, safely, that somewhere between now and the next 6 or 7 years, ideas, facts, details are going to come out that may give him an opportunity to actually get out on parole.
Yeah, I think Obama pardons him on the way out the door.
Something's going to happen.
I think Obama pardons him on the way out the door.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my view on it. You know, but, you know, the reality of this is, you know, this was a clear message to everybody else. Don't do this or this is what's going to happen to you. To me, as you said, a very chilling effect on keeping our government accountable. And that, to me, is what this is all about. You know, the video especially of the helicopter shooting a reporter, I got to be honest, pretty damning to us, something we should not be covering up.
That's correct. And if you look at Eric Snowden, call him a traitor or call him a hero or somewhere in between, the fact remains they can say all they want in Washington, anybody, the White House, the Congress, that, oh, they were looking into these things. They weren't. And only because of the exposure we having this debate today that we, you know, we find out today again, oops, 75% of everything in this country has been, quote, mined by the NSA. So that, if it wasn't for these people talking about this, whether they're right or wrong or in between, we would just be talking about something else tonight.
Yeah, well, or, you know, some kind of some nonsense, the runaway bride or something on Fox. But, you know, 75%, that's a huge number of all U.S. Internet traffic, which is something that the NSA has. That's the kind of reach they have.
I think we had no idea.
Did we not have any idea, Bob? Because I got to be honest.
Well,
I believe
mean the media,
from the beginning that, you know, somebody, every time I send an email, I'm assuming somebody's looking at it. I'm assuming the potential is there. Every time you talk on the phone, the potential is always there.
Well, I mean, when I say we, you know, I think people within the media had no idea. I will put on my former member of Congress hat. Did this shock me? No. Any of my colleagues that were there at the time of the Patriot Act, should it shock them? No. When they feign surprise, I look at them, I say, you should get an Oscar. I mean, really, all of us knew. All of us knew that that door was opened, wide open, to create all kinds of things. And it didn't come as a shock to me personally. Now, you know, it comes as a surprise that it was up to 75%.
Yeah,
that even surprised me.
I'm surprised it was that low, because that means 25%. That's where the terrorists, that's how they got away. Because it generally ends up being the dragnet, you know, the net that you cast rarely ever catches who you're going after. It catches, you know, basically, little low-level drug dealers, maybe.
Well, you know, it's amazing of a contradiction when you look at the NSA and they do all this spying, but they couldn't even tell you how much Snowden took. What does that make you feel about them, you know?
Wow. You know, and I look at Snowden and you go, my first question, right when I heard that, you know, he had sent all this stuff out, is why does he have it? I mean, and to me, it's more of the privatization. That was my first response. I'm going, why are we privatizing this stuff? Why isn't this stuff handled by us? Why is it private contractors?
That's correct. I mean, there are a lot of questions out there. How did he get it? You know, they tell you everything's safe, it's secure, they're just looking for terrorists, but yet everybody's information was in his hands that you know, that he could acquire.
Yep.
And so there are no safeguards. And that's why they need to always look at, you know, how to, if they're going to do something like this, how to make it work the best ability to protect people to go after the bad guys, not the good guys.
Now, you know, I remember when you guys were well, I shouldn't say debating the Patriot Act. I don't know that you guys really debated that. But when the Patriot Act went through, I remember going to meetings, you know, I think the League of Women Voters, where I lived in Allentown, had a big meeting. And what was interesting is they had six panelists, three people who had read the law, three people who hadn't. And I guess you could probably tell who was against it and who was for it. Obviously, the people who read it were against it, and the people who had not, they were all in favor of it. But I remember talking to people who were saying, I just want to feel safe. Just keep us safe. So I don't think those folks mind, you looking at their email and listening to their phone calls. Because, hey, Bob, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you care?
People still say that to this day. And anybody in Congress at the time of the Patriot Act, any member of Congress, had the ability to get the best legal minds on earth in their offices. That's a fact. I know we did it. The best legal minds on earth to give them both sides of that issue. If the, and a lot of people didn't do it, and they didn't read it, and they didn't know what was in the bill. That's just a fact of life. But they had this panic mentality of, well, you know, I lose the election because I'm going to be soft on Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. We got to look like we're doing something so people have the illusion of safety.
Of course.
Yeah, it's sad stuff. Let's talk about what's going on in Syria. I understand there was a chemical attack today.
Yes, we have a reporter on the ground with Talk Radio in Turkey, and he just said some astonishing things. He's going to have, you know, some information tomorrow, but they're talking in the hundreds and potentially over 1,000 some people that have been killed with chemical weapons. Of course, the Assad regime is saying it's the, you know, the quote insurgents. But the United Nations has met. They're trying to get Russia aboard. They need Russia to make a formal statement instead of an informal statement on Syria. I doubt Russia will comply, but, you know, they've got to try to pressure them. It's just a bad – it's genocide.
Yeah.
Pure and simple.
Well, what does this mean now that they've – now that it's verified somebody's used chemical weapons? I know there was the, you know, question a couple of months ago, did they not, whatever. Now we absolutely know. What does this mean?
Well, we, the United States, the White House, some members of Congress have drawn both sides, have drawn a, quote, line in the sand, if you use chemical weapons, then, and then the answer is then what? So I don't think we have the what.
Okay.
We gave the warning, Rick, but I just don't think the what is out there of you know, what we would do.
I see that the richest man in Congress, Darrell Issa, has blasted the state for not taking disciplinary action on four employees who were cited as a lack of proactive leadership in the Benghazi attack. Any more information on that?
Well, those four people have not been given their positions back, and I believe state feels that that in itself is a disciplinary action. They have not been put back into their positions. ISA is trying to... get a hold of a subpoena, of course, what's going to come out of his mouth, get a hold of, I think, how this all came about, how this was decided. Well, there's a couple of bipartisan people that were on that committee to review it. He could call them in. He could call them into the Congress if he wants, but I think he'll try the, you know, subpoena route or the questioning route of getting down to how they decided this.
I mean, haven't we already figured out there's no there?
Well, Benghazi will go away in the sense that I think anything that's come out that was wrong or mishandled is probably out there.
Right.
I don't think there's like the NSA of next surprise next week.
Yeah. Also, saw an interesting story that Representative Chris Van Hollen, along with Public Citizen and a number of other campaign finance reform advocates, they filed a lawsuit today.
Yes, this is really the story of the day here domestically. Chris Van Hollen, who's a Democratic member of the House, has filed this lawsuit with the advocacy group Public Citizen. And it's very interesting, the whole talk, of course, in D.C., and rightful so, to look and see were there Tea Party groups that were targeted by IRS, that they were 501c3s, were there liberal groups, you know, what were the target areas. But he has moved it to a different level, which is the level that needs to be questioned. And that is, why is the IRS giving clearly people who use money for political purposes tax breaks, you know, paid by the taxpayers? These groups are not paying tax. Why are they getting the breaks? And he is filing a lawsuit with the group because they want to know, you know, they want the IRS to be held accountable for giving tax status to people that clearly are using the money for political purposes.
Yeah, to go back over that, you know, originally right at the very beginning, all the Fox News and the right-wing groups were screaming, oh, they're going after us, they're going after conservatives and Tea Party. But when you step back a second, you realize they went after everybody.
They did, but at the end of the day, these groups have been operating, and they have not really looked into approval of groups that, again, Karl Rove's PAC, Rove will tell you on television, I've watched this, I don't have the exact quote, but they're an advocacy group for balancing the nation's budget. You know, but they will spend money and, of course, winks and nods and enjoy the free tax status. But is that really an advocacy group, or is it a political tool? I mean, I think we know the answer to that.
Oh, we absolutely do. But my problem with all of this is, why are we giving any of these people tax breaks at a time when we're running deficits, at a time when people are screaming about, oh, my gosh, the debt ceiling is going to fall down and kill us all? Why are we giving these people tax breaks? I don't care what side you're on.
Right.
Why are we giving tax breaks at all?
And it's ridiculous. I mean, I know of cases where, you know, a controversy comes up, and all of a sudden you've got newspaper ads in your district by a group from, you know, out west somewhere. And again, it can be, you know, liberal or conservative. Why in the first place? And that's where Chris Van Hollen is trying to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. And that's a good thing, and I'm glad to see it finally.
Absolutely.
A little late, though, but I'm glad to see better late than never. And finally, the question that is on a lot of folks' minds, is the president a racist? Evidently, Paul Page said that, governor of Maine said that Obama hates white people.
Well, he has a black dog.
Two of them.
Two of them. So, you know, I have to laugh at that because I actually read that today. Somebody said that.
Tucker Carlson's website, The Daily Caller.
Yes. I'm thinking back, let's see, what color are my dogs, you know? I mean, I'm just thinking about it. And to even actually, I hope that was a tongue-in-cheek. You know?
I don't know. Do they make white Portuguese water dogs? I don't know. I don't even know what a Portuguese water dog is.
I think they do, but, you know, but they're dogs.
Does this mean he's going to have to undergo Michael Jackson bleaching?
Or he can get a white bunny. Let it run around the lawn.
There you go. That's the solution, a white bunny.
White bunny.
Pro bunny. Bob, it's always great talking with you. Always a good time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Our good friend Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. Man, we have defended from all things unclear. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one. Just say in your car, say in mine.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, California school district doing something revolutionary. Well, not so much, unless you think wasting money on a bucket is a good idea. They're spending $36,000 on survival products. The SOS Survival Products is selling them 5-gallon buckets with toilet seats on them. Because you need portable restrooms, right? Evidently, this school district had 14 lockdowns last year. Now, understand, most of them were five, 10 minutes or less. But the longest one was 2 hours, and you might need to go. So they spent $36,000 on 1,800 of these survival kits, these lockdown kits, which is basically a 5-gallon bucket, where they've taken put a little toilet seat lid on it, roll of toilet paper, a couple of wet naps, those little wet wipe things, a waste bag, duct tape, latex gloves, a tarp, and a bag of kitty litter. All for about $20 a piece. As I did the math real quick, you're probably looking at about, if you're buying 1,800 of them, you're probably looking at about, $6 a piece. You got a profit from it. I guess somebody's brother-in-law needed a job. Also, a worker in Kentucky was hit by lightning at the Creation Museum there in Kentucky, actually in Petersburg, Kentucky. He was helping people off of the zip line they've got there. That's one of the attractions they have. Because when the world began, they had zip lines, right? You could zip right past the dinosaurs and everything. Now, understand, I've talked about this Creation Museum in the past. You may remember they said they were going to create about 700 new jobs. It was going to attract 1.2 million visitors a year, about 86% of them from out of state. It was going to have, over the next decade, a net income impact of about $119 million. Did I mention that the state gave them $43 million and an additional $11 million for roads? Yeah, the state had to throw a bunch of money into this. The part of the article that I liked, that I found interesting, the quote, and I'm reading this verbatim, the zip lines were installed in the spring to help the Christian-themed museum attract a wider group of visitors. The 1,700-foot cable is suspended 150 feet above the ground at their highest point. The whole thing, we're going to bring in all these Christians who want to learn about creation. Didn't happen. Needed a zip line to bring someone in. And here again, we believe we're going to be fine. We'll be protected. They left the people on the zip line a little too long. The worker went to help somebody off, struck by lightning. Fortunately, the worker's going to be fine. The injuries were superficial, taken to a nearby hospital, treated, released. Everything fine there. But here again, I look at this and I go, you think of all the money that we've thrown into this. The state of Kentucky, $54 million they put into this project. And it's just not working. The last reports I saw on it, it's limping along the massive impact of $119 million over the next decade, not happening. But even that, stop and think about it. You're putting in $54 million for about $11 million a year in activity. I think you could probably have spent that money better somewhere else. But, hey, maybe on buckets with toilet seats. It is the ideology. It is the ideology that matters. I guess it is what it is. And last email of the day, Ronald points out that the president has one of the worst pardon records of any post-World War II president, according to Ronald. The president wouldn't pardon Michelle's mama if she went to jail, and nor should he. I am not in favor of pardoning mother-in-laws, but you're probably right. The president does not have the greatest record. But as I said, I think on the way out the door, why not? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Email me, rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Have a great one. We'll see you back here. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at therickspitzshow.com or interact with us anytime.